part of the meeting since you chose. I'd like to call the Hess Committee meeting to order. We're glad to have present with us today some of the Hess Committee members, and also from the Senate side and also from the House side. And if there's any other legislators coming in, they can feel free to come up and have a seat up front. At this time, we're happy to have Senator Olson, who's on Education Committee. We have Senator Elton, who's also on the Hess Committee, and Representative Bart Berta Gardner is on the Hess Committee on the House side. And the chair of the Hess Committee on the House side is present with us. We thought Peggy would not be here, but she is, and we're glad to have you with us also.
Thank you.
Any other legislators coming in, they may come up. We do have online a representative on net, off-net is Representative Keller, and Senator Thomas are his staff member.
Senator Thomas is here.
Others phoning in. Senator Stevens, staff member. And anybody else that can let me know if you're here, I'm sure there'll be others. Senator Gary Stevens cannot be here, but he's going to be in town tomorrow. Wasn't able to get here today. We are happy to have with us a person that's going to come and speak with us on several topics today. And she has the full agenda, but we're going to have time for questions. And we're going to be also open for public testimony later on this afternoon. You'll be able to do that, and people may come in. I think we'll be open until 6 o'clock, where we have listed 4 to 5. Any other housekeeping things that I need to know? We will be able to tell you how to teleconference in. The telephone conference number is 888-295-4546. And you can feel free to do that. And I'm looking for my agenda, which I do not see. I got it covered up. Okay. And the first topic that we're going to take up, we're going to do the P-1620 Council presentation first. I do want to recognize that we do have school board members from Anchorage in the audience. There are other organizations that are here. You might want to identify yourself later on as we begin to ask questions and get your comments. I'm going to ask Jennifer to come forward. We have with us today Jennifer Dunay from Denver. You may come and have a seat. And I hope everything is in order for you. Mm-hmm. We have you all set up.
Yep.
All right. Is there any comments that need to come from the legislators that are present before we get started with the presentation? No comments at this time. Okay.
All right.
Well, we'll welcome you here, and we're glad to have you.
Thank you, Senator Davis,
okay,
for the invitation today. Thanks to all of you for coming. Thanks to all of our guests for coming today. And let me know if I need to speak up a little bit. I don't know how the microphone is. I don't have a very large voice.
I don't know if it's working as well as it should, because I'm not hearing you that well. Everybody in the audience, you have a copy of the presentation? Okay.
Is that better? Okay. You can hear me better now? Okay, great.
Yeah.
And as was mentioned, I'm from Education Commission of the States. For anyone who's not familiar with ECS, we're a 50-state nonpartisan education organization based in Denver, and we were explicitly based in Denver just to be away from the sort of partisan politics of the Beltway. We serve just as P-16, P-20 councils convene members representing all different types of education constituencies. ECS considers its primary constituents all levels of state policymakers, so governors and their staffs, legislators and their staffs, state board members and superintendents, higher education leaders of all types. So it's really a privilege and honor to be here with you today to speak about P16. And so I'm going to use the term P16. You also sometimes hear today K20, P20, et cetera. I'm using P16 just because it's a little bit simpler. The majority of states that have such councils use this term, and it's to refer to P, either as in pre-kindergarten or preschool, to 16, which is the first 4 years of undergraduate. And other states have created P20 councils where they consider the 20 to be undergraduate plus graduate or first professional degrees, doctoral degrees, and so on. In fact, in one state, South Dakota, they even have a P21 council. I haven't figured out what the 21 is referring to, but P16 is the most common term being used today. So in these states that have these sort of P16 efforts, it usually involves the creation of a council. So as of 2008, there are 38 states that have created a P16 or P20, K20 council. And it goes beyond just the establishment of a council. It also includes data systems. So many states are trying to align the K-12 data system with the post-secondary data system so they know what happens to students once they graduate from high school. Are they staying in the state? Are they going to a two-year or four-year college and so on? It also is talking about funding mechanisms. Traditionally, K-12 and post-secondary are both lobbying the legislature or other sources for the same pot of money. It can kind of create some sort of tension or friction between the systems rather than collaboration. Also talking about ways of thinking, you know, not thinking about schooling ending at grade 12 or separating pre-kindergarten or early learning from the rest of the system, but an aligned system. And then public support. In a lot of cases, parents, students, the general public, they have no idea that there's these three different systems operating in isolation from one another. And so getting that word out to the public and trying to generate support. And then lastly, decision-making through the executive office, through legislatures, through state boards, other policy-making bodies in the state, so that everyone is on the same page in terms of what the needs are in the state and how different entities can collaborate rather than compete in order to meet these needs. And so there are two or three different ways of looking at the need for P16. I briefly touched on them a moment ago. One is from a former ECS staff member who is a parent, and she talks about how, as a parent, you can try to do all the right things for your child. You can put your child into a pre-kindergarten. You can send your child to what you think is a good school program. You can try to encourage your child to consider going to college, going to a good college. But in all of those different sectors, you can do all what you think are all the right things, and yet your child won't be ready for the next level. So you can put your child in a preschool program, but maybe the preschool program is totally disaligned with what the child needs to be able to know and do when they enter kindergarten or first grade. The child is going through elementary school, but the middle school has a completely different agenda, curriculum, et cetera, from what the elementary grades have. Or your child's entering high school, and what they need to know to be successful in ninth grade and beyond was not taught to them in the middle grades. And then you have the post-secondary system, and the high school graduation requirements are completely disassociated from the courses, the assessments, et cetera, that you need to enter a college program and be successful. Another way of looking at it is what you see here, the passing the buck. You have on the left-hand side the employers, and they're pointing their fingers at two-year, four-year colleges, like, why are you sending us these people to work in our organizations, our companies, and these people don't know how to write, they don't know how to think, they don't know math. The two- and four-year programs are looking back at the high schools. Why are you sending us these graduates who are in remediation for reading or math once they come to our programs? The high schools are pointing behind them. The middle school is pointing behind them. And everyone's pointing their fingers at the parents. Like, why are you not preparing your kids to be ready to learn, to be ready to go to school when they come to us? And so P16 programs are designed, rather than having everyone pointing the finger at the person behind them, to have an aligned system so that everyone is on the same page. Everyone understands what's expected in the system before and after that component of the system. And so in June of 2008, ECS launched a 50-state database on P16 and P20 councils, and this was summarized in the June 2008 Diplomas Count. I have about 10 copies behind you if any of you wants to grab a copy afterwards, but the Diplomas Count provides sort of a cliff notes of the ECS database. It starts on about page 17, and they've coded about 15 different data points into simple yes, no, or other short answers, so it's a really quick and easy way to go through. The full database is available at ecs.org/P20. We really went through a rigorous process to develop this database, And ECS has been tracking P16 since the late 90s, the beginning of this decade, and it just builds upon and provides a really comprehensive picture of what's happening in the states. Like I mentioned, it has 15 indicators, and most of the indicators are in the diplomas count. The full list is online. And we're going to look through three different types of indicators that are included in the database. There's also a commentary in this diplomas count that I authored, and in the commentary it mentions the three sort of essential components of P16, that's actors, agenda, and appropriation of resources. And in this presentation, I'll try to walk you through some of the indicators in the database that will align with those three A's and what best practice in state policy appears to be at this time.
Jennifer, could I stop you for a moment?
Sure.
I should have taken care of this before you got started, but I want to know what the process is. I know we're going to have questions answered after you're done, but would it be okay for members to ask questions while you're doing the presentation, or
Certainly.
Would you prefer that we just wait?
I think it's fine if you ask, you know, during the presentation.
Up to this point, are there any questions that need to be asked? I see Senator Elton's hand. There might be others. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Jennifer, I'm sorry to interrupt, but before I get left too far behind, you've talked about, you know, what the goals of the councils are. Are the councils that have been established, are they legislative? Are they executive? Are they a mix? I mean,
it's a real mix. And I think my next slide or one of my next slides is going to be setting out which states or how many states have set up the councils either through executive order, through legislation, through a voluntary effort.
Okay, great. I'll wait.
That's a good question.
Yeah,
those
it is
things
a good question.
We will pick up, but yes.
Okay.
Was there anyone else? If not, you may continue.
Thank you. So, in fact, this is the next slide. Who's lobbying for alignment? And here I've tried to set out the different entities that have pushed for the creation of a P16 or a P20 council. And so, as you can see, in 11 states, it's through executive order. In 10 states, it's through legislation. In 14 states, it's an entirely voluntary effort, and in 2 states, it was through a state board resolution or state board rule. And I should mention that these have really changed over time. And so, for example, in Georgia, created the very first P16 council in 1996 through an executive order of then Governor Zell Miller. And then in 2002, a new governor was in place, and he lobbied for legislation to be enacted, which was creating a totally different P16 council with its own members and agenda and so on. And then after that governor left office, while the statute stayed on the books, the council started to sort of evolve away from what was in statute. And now the current entity at the Alliance of Agency Heads is clearly a voluntary effort of the various agency heads of early learning, K-12, post-secondary, and so on. And we've seen a similar evolution in other states where a state may have had a voluntary council, such as in Maryland, Nevada, Illinois, and then in Nevada and Illinois, legislation was enacted within the last couple of years that created a new agenda, new members, et cetera. In Maryland, it was an executive order in late 2007 that changed the voluntary efforts into those that are sort of led by the governor's office and set, again, a new agenda.
Could I just hold your thought right there so I can recognize a couple more members who showed up? We had for a while Senator Higgins here. He's now over here on my right, and we also have over here on my left and on my right, we have Senator Representative Sharon Cisner. She serves on HESS committee on the House side. Anybody else? Any other legislators in the room? You may continue.
Okay, so as you can see, these councils are by no means set in stone. The way that they've been created changed. The members who are leading them changed. The members themselves are constantly in a state of flux. And so here we have the actors, the second A of the three A's. And in many states, you can see legislators are represented. In virtually, if not all states, chiefs and SHIOs, presidents of 2- and 4-year post-secondary institutions are represented. And I should also mention a fair number of states where independent universities or colleges have a voice, they are also represented?
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
Thank you. I'm not sure I know what SHIELDS are.
Oh, State Higher Education Executive Officers, so yes.
Thank you.
And in a number of councils, We have a representative of the governor's office, and in 8 councils, the governor, him or herself, leads the council. And then in many other states, we have business and labor leaders. Those could be somebody from an executive branch, economic or workforce development, and other places it may be just the Chamber of Commerce president, a whole variety of different types of leaders. If you go through the ECS database, you'll see the diversity of the types of individuals who fill out the business and labor roles, and then others. So, for example, in Arizona, where there's a large American Indian population, they have tribal representatives. In some other places, such as California, where there are a number of nonprofit organizations or foundation representatives, they have those represented on the council. And although I mentioned that P16 means early learning, as a matter of fact, in only 18 states do they have an explicit early learning representative on the council. And so once a state has created a P16 or P20 council, it's not, you know, like you've crossed that off the list, the problem solved, it's all taken care of. It's really only the very beginning. You have, I believe, in your packet a draft of a policy brief that will be coming out later this month on landmines of P16 councils. And that I'll be happy to send you a final copy once that's prepared. But there are a lot of challenges that P16 or P20 councils face even after they've been created. So here I'm going to go through a little bit, unpack a little bit more the three A's I mentioned earlier. And so in some states where they have created a P16 council, they have a group that may be too small. It doesn't have for example, policymakers or other leaders to take back to their constituencies what needs to be done by the legislature, by the state board, by the governor's office, et cetera. And I call it here Goldilocks. You don't want it too big. You don't want it too small. In some other states, there are so many members and so few of those do have authority in their own agency or organization to enact change that they've sort of lost their focus a little bit. There are so many community members not sure what their role is on the council. In other states, I have early learning here. They don't have explicit early learning representation, and that creates a problem because early learning is just not on the agenda, and there's so much research, I'm sure you're all aware of, brain research, the amount of information that young children are able to learn at such earlier ages than we previously thought, the importance of getting a good start in order to be ready to enter kindergarten and first grade. In other states where they don't have legislative or gubernatorial representation, there can be parallel tracks where the legislature is trying to get one thing done and they're not involved with the council, and then the council is trying to get its own thing done, and you can imagine it creates some problems. The business community is important to include. It's gone into further depth in the policy brief, but the business community can identify for states, lawmakers and other leaders, the needs that are not being met in terms of not producing enough high school or post-secondary graduates in specific fields, or that these graduates are not adequately prepared. Business community members can also sit in when K-12 and post-secondary faculty are trying to determine what's needed for high school completion, for college readiness, and speak to what the workforce needs are in those two areas. When you don't have the right actors in place, sometimes there can also be confusion about what the council's mission is, what the roles of the different members are. And we've also found it's extremely important that a council meet at least quarterly basis, because when they meet less frequently, there's a tendency towards inertia. People don't feel such a sense of urgency about moving forward with items on the agenda. They tend to forget what was happened at previous meetings and so on. And so we have found that the majority of P16 councils do meet on at least a quarterly basis at this time.
I do have another question here, Senator Elton.
Thanks. And Jennifer, this is a great presentation, and it just prompts my mind to get too busy perhaps. So if you're going to address this later, feel free to do it. I'm sitting here listening, and I'm trying to think of a rationale for a P16 council rather than a P20 council, because it seems to me, I mean, one of the big issues in our states, I think probably in other states, is how students are prepared how they're prepared, you know, to go on and get the kind of education they need. So if for example, you're discussing how to get high school students prepared for college, why wouldn't you discuss why you don't need to get college students prepared for grad school?
I have to say that a lot of the P20 councils don't actually go beyond the first 4 years of college in the scope of their agenda, and that's why I'm using the term P16 more. But there are a small number of states that are looking at sort of economic and workforce development as part of their P16 or B20 council agenda, and I think that's where the advanced degrees come in. And in those states with P20 councils, I think that some of them are also addressing the 20 side of the equation by looking at advanced degrees for teachers, administrators, other school staff. I don't know.
Medical professionals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
And it started to address that, and that is something that needs to be discussed, you know, at our level, at the state level, if we're going to decide. You know, we'll determine if we want 16 through 20, but we do want to hear all aspects of it. So this is just a way for us to have you know about pre-16. We've gone to meetings that ECS has had, took a group back to Boston back in March of this year. We had educators, we had businessmen there, women, men and women. We had people from the State Board of Education. We had other legislators, myself and Senator Stevens, that was present. We heard the presentations there, and I've been hearing about councils for quite some time. The present commissioner that we have is very much interested in that, and there is going to be an education summit so that we can get the views of not just legislators but all the people throughout the state to talk about in which direction we would like to go. And we want to, at that time, if we decide to do it, to have ours in statute rather than have it be done in some of the other ways that have been discussed with you. So that's sort of what we are, where we are at this point.
Thank you.
Okay? Any other questions? Okay.
And maybe as an addendum to your question, of the states that have created a council within the last 5 years, I think it would be safe to say that the majority of them have created a P20 council, and maybe it's from that recognition that stopping at P16 isn't enough. And then there's the devil's advocate, other side of that, saying we're not doing the 16 well enough, so why are we going on to 20? So there are two sides of looking at that issue. And so in terms of what we've seen in the creation of councils, what kind of work they're setting out for themselves, we think we found that, at least at the outset, it's important not to set too broad of an agenda, that the most successful councils start out with five or fewer issues to tackle, and then once you start to develop some traction around those issues, start to see some results, then maybe expand the scope. So one of the few states that has more than five issues on its agenda is Indiana. You may have heard of the Education Roundtable there, and they've been in place for about 10 years, and I think they started out with a smaller agenda of just the high school to post-secondary transition, and now their current agenda is much broader, includes early learning, dropout prevention, teacher preparation and quality, a whole array of issues. I'd be happy to send you a link to their plan that they developed in 2003 that sets out the different pieces of their 10-item agenda.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. One thing I'm looking at, just kind of at a glance here, is that we have so many different groups that want so many different things to happen. And we have the people that want preschool things happening for those younger students. We have people that are saying that there's not enough. When the kids go to college, they have to do too much remedial stuff, and so that they want that to be taken care of. And it looks to me like if all of those different groups can be involved on this one program, that they can all work together and maybe get more done than as they each do it individually.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. Yeah, and in some of the best P16 councils, Indiana, Georgia, it's clear that they're doing things that they couldn't be doing by themselves. So Georgia, which, you know, I mentioned earlier, was created in 1996. The post-secondary is involved with early learning because they're developing programs to get highly trained staff into those preschools, pre-kindergartens, early learning programs. K-12 and post-secondary are working together to try to reduce the need for remediation, and they're also working together. One of the main items that many states are working on through their P16 Council is teaching quality, because there's sort of this continuous loop. The kids who go through your high schools, go into your colleges, some of them become teachers, go back to the schools, And then those teachers prepare the next students who will go into your colleges of education and so on. And so if there's a poor quality of poor preparation of students who are entering the teacher preparation programs, and then the preparation programs are trying to work to prepare those kids, those young adults, to come back to the schools. So Georgia has made teaching quality one of the main components of its P16 agenda over a number of years, and they've seen gains in SAT scores, assessment scores that really indicate that they're doing something right there in terms of their teacher preparation. So speaking to the agenda, we have something each agency can't do alone, as we're mentioning with Georgia. Also, in 16 states, they have set, rather than setting a goal, like we want more students to be prepared for college or more young children to go to early learning programs, et cetera, in these 16 states, they have numerical goals with a future date set in mind. So we want the graduation rate to increase by 12% by such and such year, or we want X more students to enter 2 or 4 year institutions by such and such year, or we want to double the number of bachelor's degrees awarded in the state by 2020. Arizona and Kentucky both have set that goal for themselves. And then lastly, in Georgia, we also have a balanced scorecard, so they're not just holding vague people out in the system responsible, but they have specific targets. So what does it mean to prepare more teachers well? It's probably a little bit small to see this. I have a link at the bottom of this slide where you can go check out the full balanced scorecard. It goes on for pages and pages, but in many states they talk about getting more math and science teachers prepared. And you can see here the performance measure on the far left is USG, University System of Georgia, teacher production. What's the method of measurement? They have it broken out for many different indicators in terms of preparing more minority students to become teachers, preparing for biology, chemistry, physics, earth science. And you see the next bar over is the baseline year. Some of these are yet in the future. They haven't set a baseline yet. Some of these are for 2007. And then they go forward to the 2007 results. What's the 2008 target? And as you can see, this is still a work in progress. When this was last updated, November of last year, they hadn't set targets for some of these yet. But as you scroll through, I think it's about 15 pages, this full document. It's a really comprehensive look. If we say we're going to get more math and science teachers prepared, and we want that to be a more diverse workforce, et cetera, here are the specifics we want to accomplish by such and such year, and they have a staff person responsible for overseeing each of those components. And there are a few other states that have gotten this specific in terms of setting forth what they want to do year by year and a plan for achieving it. And so the last A is appropriation of resources, and this is talking about financial resources and then, in a corollary, human resources. So we've seen about half the states either have legislative appropriation or they have built into their agency budgets some funds to support the work of the council. It could be either, as I'll mention later, some staff funding, or it could be communications to get the word out to the public. This is really important, and this is why the state needs this work done. In a small number of states, they receive private funds. In California, they have several foundations in the state that support the work of the council. Colorado has an Intel grant that supports some STEM work that they're getting done. Arizona is sort of interesting. They have a number of casinos run by tribal groups, and state law requires the tribal groups to donate a certain percentage of their winnings to charitable or nonprofit or governmental operations, and at least one tribal organization donates to the P20 Council to support some of the work that that council is doing. Nebraska takes a different approach. They have a three-tiered system of support. The first tier would be the K-12 and post-secondary agencies and a nonprofit foundation who provide basic operating expenses. The second tier are smaller state-level organizations. I think the state superintendents and so on provide small portions of money. And then a third tier are civic and other organizations that provide in-kind support, such as meeting rooms, food for meetings, other sorts of staff as needed on an as-needed basis. And then lastly, Wyoming, I think, is the only state that among the various subcommittees of the P16 Council, they have a sustainability subcommittee, and the goal of this group is to identify and receive funds from three types of entities, governmental, foundation, and business, so that there's not too much stress just on one or the other to support the council's work. And then in terms of human resources, in 21 councils, there is at least a 0.5 FTE supporting the work of the council. And at least one of the articles in this diplomas count talks about Kentucky and how they've been in place for some time. They've gotten a good amount of work done, but they're looking at creating a council possibly through legislation so that they can get the appropriations to get the staff in place to get the work done. North Carolina and Georgia have a two-tiered approach where they have a small group of agency heads who are meeting on a quarterly or less frequently basis. And then in North Carolina, they call it the kitchen cabinet, who meets every 6 or 8 weeks. Each kitchen cabinet member is a staff member for the higher ed education cabinet, and they get the work done, move it forward. And I think actually that's the conclusion of my formal comments.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. I would like to know if Shirley Holloway is on off net, since she's not present, and maybe she will join us later on. She's been doing a lot of work on P16 councils and very much interested in that. It has gotten a grant, and I don't want to go into that. I think she's going to discuss that if she's going to be here at around 2 o'clock. We'll let her. Yes?
I don't think Shirley is going to be with us today. I'm John Shackleford from the Foundation. I work with Shirley.
Oh, okay. Would you be able to say anything about what she is doing in that light with the P16 councils and the study that's been done at this time? Okay, so I will call you up instead of her then at that one. Thank you very much. Now, as we began to ask the questions, I guess, just to get you, and I do want to apologize to Charlie Huggins. I think I call him Higgins when he came into the room. I do know your name.
My wife calls me AU sometimes.
But I want to make that correction. Excuse me, please. As you prepare your questions and all, what's going to happen? There's going to be an education summit that's going to take place in November. It's going to be a statewide summit, and some of these things, though, issues that's going to be discussed. And that would put us on the track to decide on how we want to move forward based upon the information that we gather, if we want to do a pre-16 or a P16 or P20 council. At this point, most people are saying they want it to be in statute rather than just have an executive order that may go away when that person go away or whatever. But that's part of the discussion. But the big discussion will come up in November. Mm-hmm. And I see Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know the dates in November?
Yeah, we do have those dates. I'll get my staff to get the dates for you. I thought it had been given out. I don't know. Do you know the dates?
I understand that in talking to the department, I believe it was going to be the 17th to the 19th. I can stand to
We'll get the correct dates for you. Just call my office and ask them to pull that. So it's going to be a three. We will get the dates and give it to you.
13th and 14th.
Like I said, call to the office and ask them to get the information. Okay. Any other questions at this point? Yes.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And Jennifer, a great presentation. I'm on the slide that says appropriation of resources, and I'm kind of curious. You suggest that there are three states that receive private funds.
Mm-hmm. There are more than three states. I just, as a mental reminder, that you have three different types of funds.
Okay. I'm curious as to how that works. I mean, we sometimes get trapped in the notion that the people who provide the funding have the biggest voice. Yeah. And so, are there issues if, in fact, funding is coming from one source, and if that one source is thereby made unhappy because of decisions that are made by the council, whether or not that funding just dries up or disappears?
Yeah, and that actually is something at the very end of the policy brief. I think there's a short list of questions. Like, we don't know the answers yet, and I think that may be one of them. But because so many councils are so relatively new, and especially the ones that are receiving private funds, many of them seem to be relatively new, it's not clear as of yet if the people providing the private funds are sort of calling the shots, if you will, in terms of what the work of the council is doing. But I brought this in because I know that in some states there's really a budget crisis and there are very limited legislative or other state funds to appropriate to these councils. And it's clear that when states aren't appropriated. They're just doing sort of pro bono or however you want to say work. It's a real challenge at times to find adequate staff to get the work moving forward. You know, they can come meet four times a year and talk about what they would like to get done, but there's no traction under that in order to get the work done in the state.
And then a follow-up question.
May.
Jennifer, how do the other councils do this? You had mentioned staff, and I'm curious as to whether or not staff is provided by the Department of Education or staff is just whether the budgets provide or are big enough, you know, to hire staff. I mean, how do they do the staffing issue?
It varies, and actually one of the data points in the database, if you want to look at in greater detail, is under the minimum 0.5 FTE indicates whether it's the Department of Education, post-secondary, the governor's office, someone else who's providing the staff. And off the top of my head, I can't remember how it breaks out. But one of the other things, again, we don't know for sure yet, is does it make a difference if the staff is coming from the governor's office versus the Department of Education? With term limits in some states, it could be that the governor's staff are all fairly new or that they're going to be leaving, you know, within a year or 2 years' time. Or is it something that's coming from the governor's office going to have more weight than something that's coming from either the Department of Education or post-secondary? It's really not clear as of yet.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Yeah, and just to follow up on that, that's why it's so important that each state decides what's going to be in their best interest and how they want to do it. But what I hear as I travel around and talk to people about the councils, many of them are agreeing that they think it should be in statute and that we should have the guidelines there, things that have to be carried out. I really don't know which direction we will end up in, but when we went to that meeting in Boston, we had two members from the State Chamber of Commerce, one from the State Chamber of Commerce, one from Anchorage Chamber. They are very much interested in having business representation there. The council should be made up of parents, educators, business people. And as you know, what the one big problem we have is the high dropout rate that we have, and so many of our children moving off to college that's not prepared for college, even though they have graduated, and some even with honors, end up in college and find themselves taking remedial courses. And that's why the alignment is so important to have, because each level we're working and making sure that the children are getting what they want as they move into the next level. And this is one way of us making sure that we address it and help everybody. What the businessmen expect from our students when they graduate, what requirements they think they should have gotten, what the college think they should have, that we will have them prepared for that, and even moving on to the next level. So that's why I think it's so important that we do consider having this kind of alignment, because there's a lot of work that we have to do. And I'm really looking forward to having that summit so that we can further discuss that and bring the parental party and the parents in, because that's one thing that we did not take with us when we went to Boston. We didn't have an identified parent. Some of the people who were there had children, but we didn't identify the PTA or somebody else to go along with it. It was such a short notice that we had to do it, and we were not able to get everybody that we thought needed to be there. But now that we're bringing it back home to our level, we'll have all those people at the table and discuss that. Any other questions from the presenter? And also, this is for the audience. If you have questions, you may come forward, state your name and your affiliation, and ask your question. Any questions? Even any statements, comments from anybody on this particular topic?
Chairman Davis?
Yes, who is it?
It's Senator Thomas from Fairbanks.
All right, Senator Thomas, glad to have you.
Yes, it is an interesting presentation, and I had a question regarding are there reasons why states do not simply, or maybe some have, include or expand their existing Department of Education to include this type of a committee, or however you want to refer to it, therefore not setting something up outside of the Department of Education?
I'm not able to answer if there are other states that's doing it that way. Those are the discussions that we could have here in the outstate to see if we want to do it. And one of the states that I really want to watch very closely that is just beginning their pre-16 and doing quite well is the state of Colorado. And so we'll have a lot of examples for you. And I'm going to ask the person that's going to come up and speak, start up for us, Shirley Holloway, to come forward. Maybe you can add some information as what kind of information she's having gathered. That might be helpful to the answer to his question. You can just pull another chair up or... come to one of these, it doesn't matter.
This is Don.
State your name for the record.
Don Shackelford. I work for the Avant-Garde Learning Foundation. So one of the things that our foundation is doing, and our president and CEO is Dr. Shirley Holloway. Many of you know, former commissioner and currently a school board, state school board member. We have several initiatives going on, but the one that's pertinent to this conversation is an alignment study that we have commissioned through the Institute of Social and Economic Research at ICER at UAA. And in that study, we are looking at the very questions that this panel is discussing today. We're primarily interested in the apparent gap between high school graduation and college entrance, and also high school graduation and those students who go on to work in careers that maybe require some technical training or they don't require technical training, and how well prepared they are. So really, it's an alignment study, but it's a preparedness study as well for students graduating from high school and going to college. And we're asking questions such as, what are the requirements that people meet that they have to meet in order to graduate from high school in the state of Alaska? Where are people coming out? Which schools are people being successful in? Is there a discrepancy between urban and rural graduation and what that might mean in terms of people's performance in schools? And one of the ways that we're looking at that is, what are the colleges and universities in Alaska looking at in terms of what people need to know in writing and reading, in mathematics, and in science? And so what are the sort of baseline entry-level 101 courses that people are being offered in colleges, and why is it, how many of our people are having to go into what we call developmental classes, remedial classes? That number seems to be anecdotally quite large. Why is that? What can we do to address that issue? What is it that we need to look at in terms of high schools and in colleges to better align those expectations and put those and put us closer together where we need to be? And the study will be preliminarily completed by the 1st of November. It will be ready for the conference that you referenced, Madam Chairwoman, on the 13th or 14th or whenever it is in November. And we hope to be able to utilize the study as a starting point for conversation based upon data and not just people's feeling of what they think is happening, but actually what we've discovered, and to take that and utilize that for our conversation so we can look at ways to address this issue, including the possibility of a P-16 or P-20 council. So that's the work that we're doing.
Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. One question I have, and I would imagine this would be hard for you to even evaluate, but what I have found lots of times is that the attitude of the parents has a lot to do with it. And my district is considered all rural, where my district is. However, some of the areas are much more inaccessible than others. And we're finding that the parents that are in those inaccessible areas, and if they've been there a long time, some of them aren't as concerned about their children's education as others. And so what's happening is that if a child is, and I don't know how you can evaluate that, but in some areas, and maybe it's a town by itself or whatever, but the school, it's hard for the schools to deal with it because they can't control the attitude of the parents, and so sometimes another town might it's really, education is really important, and the parents are at the school and helping out and stuff like that. And those make a difference in the attitude of the kids and whether how important school is. So where do you go from in those areas? How do you evaluate that?
It's difficult to evaluate those kinds of things because, obviously, it's very complicated. And as educators, which is what those of us who are doing this are, I mean, we really don't have much control over parents, obviously. We have, however, a great deal to say about what goes on in the schools, and part of that has to do with our relationships with parents and how well we develop those relationships with people in communities. And the schools where there are the communities that I've experienced, and I've spent a lot of time working in the last 30-some-odd years working in the state, both rural and urban, I know of several very good schools that are in rural Alaska that have a lot of participation by parents because the schools have made that outreach. So there are some things that we can look at, and I think a P16 council, for instance, could look at how better to reach out to parents and to get communities involved and to get parents involved and to have that be a meaningful sort of involvement. I don't know how to evaluate that, but I do see that just from my own perspective as a big issue, because we know that schools that have higher parental involvement have better are better schools.
Thank you.
If I can add to that, actually, we actually, ECS published a policy brief. I have one printed copy with me today. I was going to mention it during the dropout prevention section of today's agenda, but it looks at different types of approaches that states can use in order to create a structure for high schools to provide parental involvement, to support parental involvement, because in many cases, parents feel that they need to be involved in the earlier grades, and then parental involvement drops away during the middle or high school years, when research clearly indicates that setting high expectations for their child at the high school level, providing supports as they're looking at college or other types of post-high school options are really essential in terms of guidance.
Any other comment in that area? If there's anybody in the audience and you're not signed up to say that you want to say anything at this point, you still may have that opportunity. You need any comments from the audience? Is there anyone off net that have a comment to make? Identify yourself. Come up. I didn't see you, but do come up.
Well, I first want to apologize to myself when we're not taking the type of escape. I know you're taking public comments.
We're not taking public comments when it's for his testimony until 4 o'clock. Well, this is just for the discussion period. If you have a comment to make or a question to ask of the presenter, you may do that. That's pretty much what it is at this point.
Well,
we're not taking public comment until 4 o'clock.
Well, I guess
after we've finished all the presentations.
Well, you cut me off guard by that. I have strong concerns. I think they're more along the lines of the cost.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else? If not, what we're going to do, we're going to take a short break at this point. We're going to let you get your next package together. Did you have further comments that you wanted to make concerning to the P16?
No, that's it for now. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much. Take a short break.
Look at that.
So State Flair is here. He can give it.
Oh, that's wonderful. Do you have friends here?
But he's here now, so he'll be able to give it. Yeah, I understand.
What are you going to do? Are the trains running, passenger trains?
You know, I don't know. We talked about going to Homer or Seward.
If you go to Seward, you can take the train. It's really a fabulous train ride.
Really?
It's long.
Oh, it's not the same. Oh, it's something else. It's different. It's another breed.
We also talked about a float plane, but I don't know if it's, cloudy like this, if that's really worth it.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Thank you very much. I'd like to call this meeting back to order at this time. It is now 10 minutes after 2, and we are happy to have with us the Commissioner of Education, Larry Ledoux. And before we go on with our next presentation, I'm going to have Larry to come up. You might want to make a few comments or whatever. I'm going to leave that up to you. And we could still be on schedule and start our next one at 2:15 or whatever time we need to. And we want to make sure you come and speak directly into the microphone to all the members. Make sure you call your name off and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Senator.
And we're going to start on our next presentation at 2:30. Welcome, Larry. Glad to have you.
Thank you, Senator. I apologize for being late. I was scheduled to be at a Putting a Alaska to Work Coalition meeting, and I drove around the block and went through two intersections, or slid through, and I decided that I was just going to go back to the garage and, and attend another meeting. So a higher power has me here.
Right.
Well, I'm delighted to be here. These are two topics that I'm very interested in to learn about and that the Department of Education is very interested and I think are very important to Alaska. We've been working hard at the Department of Education to take a look at the success of our kids, and one of the statistics that keeps coming to mind is that we're losing 40 out of 100 of our students. And when people ask me about that, I usually say, I'm one of those people that if you lose one, you leave the 99 and you go find them. And in this case, I'm leaving the 60 and trying to find the 40 that we're losing in Alaska. And it's a complicated issue, and too many times when we run into complicated issues, we just don't do anything about it. I think we need to start. We need to work on it. It's not acceptable. So one of the things that I've discovered as commissioner is that I get calls every day from people who ask for help in filling up holes or putting out fires or responding to crises in education or needing funds to carry on a worthy project. And I don't like to operate that way. I don't like to react to things. As a high school principal, I have buried too many young people, and we've gotten very good at helping kids after they fall off the cliff, or as you may have heard, we're very good at parking our ambulances at the bottoms of cliffs. I'm tired of that. I'm tired of waiting to be forced by the death or destruction of kids to do what we all know is important, and I appreciate your leadership in bringing this group together. So I know that we have to, in order for us not to be reacting, to be proactive instead of reactive, we have to start planning. And it came to my mind early as I started working with the transition team and talking to other Alaskans that there is no education plan in Alaska. There is no broad-range strategic plan for the state of Alaska, and there never has been since statehood. And that sort of shocked me because planning is important. I don't mean planning so that we can use it to hide behind doing nothing, but planning that holds us accountable, planning that allows us to direct our resources to a common direction, planning that allows us to prevent our kids from falling off cliffs or walking away. So as part of that, the state of Alaska and the University of Alaska, who is joining with us, is sponsoring an education summit for the state of Alaska to build an education plan. The outcomes of our summit are to define a vision and a mission for the state of Alaska for our kids that we can all look at and feel good about. We're also going to develop some graduation outcomes that we believe are important. We believe that citizenship is important in Alaska. Where do we teach it? We believe that working ethically and honestly, using technology, the understanding of the arts, mastery of a wide body of knowledge, the ability to understand service and contributions to your community. Those are important, but we don't state them anywhere. And so our summit is going to take a look at some of the broader statements of what we want our graduates to look like when they leave school. Right now in Alaska, you can graduate with a D-minus average and 23 credits, and you can pass an exam that's based, for instance, in math, 80% of it, on eighth grade standards. I believe we need more, and I've always known working with young people that whatever standard we set, they can meet it. Our kids aren't all leaving our education institution because they can't make the grade. Many of the people that drop out pass our tests. They're walking away because our system doesn't always meet their needs. It's not because they're not always interested. It's just that kids nowadays are learning in real time. Watch them with their phones. Watch when they want to know something, they go learn it. They're not interested in sitting in a seat for 180 days, you know, to earn a credit. They're going out and finding out what they want to do, and they don't wait for us anymore. And, of course, we all know the tragedy of kids that just sort of fall away because of drugs and alcohol. And so I want a system that builds vision in every child. The other component of the summit is to set some specific goals and objectives. We're going to look at education from birth to work, if you will. Although we don't have responsibility for young people in the womb or, you know, from before they come to school, I can tell you we pay the price if we're not interested. So I'm not saying we're going to take responsibility, but I'm not afraid to work collaboratively with those agencies that do take a look at that to make sure that we're all working together. So we're hoping that we will have goals and objectives that address the needs of Alaska's youth from preschool all the way through helping them find a job or to go through further post-secondary training. We expect to have 400 folk from around the state. This is by invite. Here's how we're sending out invitations. We have solicited names and leaders and movers and shakers in business and industry and services. We've asked each superintendent to bring four invitees to the summit: a superintendent, a school board member, a community leader or politician, somebody in there, or business person, and then a teacher or a principal. The university is inviting over 100 people themselves. This is the first time we've ever worked that closely with the university system. It's phenomenal. We are also inviting 150 agency heads, leaders, people that are involved with young people in the state of Alaska. Invites are not taking place by point of view. In fact, I hope to have people in that room that normally don't want to be in the same room with one another. I want diverse opinions. We need to talk about what we know and believe about Alaska, and that will unify us. Goals, objectives, we're going to ask groups to tell us what success will look like. What will it look like if we accomplish this goal and objective? Who are the people that are going to be involved in helping us achieve that goal? And what are some of the opportunities and challenges we'll face on the way? The real work for the summit will take place afterwards. We're going to have to put work groups together, teams, focus groups, whatever you want to call them. We'll bring together all throughout Alaska groups of people that will start developing action plans that really say, what are we going to do? When are we going to do it? How are we going to do it? Who's going to do it? What will it cost? I believe this is important because the issues facing us, again, as I started, are very complex. So we're going to break them down into their parts, and we're going to set some goals and objectives and challenge them. It's frightening, but I really don't know how I can do my job well. I know how to do things and make them happen. I've been an administrator, teacher for 30 years. I know how to do flashy programs. To do something that looks like it's good, and maybe for a season it will have an impact, but I've seen too many great programs come into being and then disappear. I believe that we need to work together, address it together. It may mean spending more money, but I think that if we know where we're going, if we're accountable, we'll actually save money, and I can say that without smiling most of the time. So that's where we are. That's the dream. What you're doing today, you're talking about two very important issues. I will tell you up front, I believe we do need a K-20 commission. We should never have silos. We should never have departments that separate what we do. The Department of Education, or K-12, is intimately related to the university system. We need to work hand in hand. They prepare our teachers. They provide research. They provide our staff development. Our kids attend their university. So we've opened up that dialogue. I've met with the university president several times and his staff. We've agreed to meet monthly, and that's a good step forward. I've been meeting with Abby Hensley, who's just, I've just met her. We've met several times. But we're talking about the little ones, and she's certainly a leader. So we're trying to build bridges, fill the gaps, and we're starting with an education summit. I'm excited about it. I'm idealistic about it. I'm scared. You know, having that many people in one room and trying to coordinate them and come up with something. But I believe the summit is the start of a start, just like what you're doing here. So can I answer any questions about anything?
Thank you very much. Yes, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. We had a little discussion about the date of the summit. Can you tell us definitively?
I can tell you definitively.
Yes.
That the date of the summit is November 13 and 14. It'll be at the Dynina Center. And although we're planning on sending out our invites, by the way, we're inviting the legislature too, just so you know. And we'll be sending out our general invites, I believe, this week. And as people indicate or RSV back whether they're coming or not, we'll be expanding that because we want increased representation from some of our more urban centers. The invites, the way we're doing districts, will bring in people from all over rural Alaska by doing it with school districts because most of our districts are rural. But we're also concerned that we don't overlook the number of kids that we have in our urban centers, too, and we want wide representation. So we'll be – I can even tell you that at the banquet that night we're having – potato-wrapped halibut. I don't know much about it, but my secretary told me that's what she's picked. So,
another question?
Yes, thank you. And I don't know if you have the answer
it's
now.
Representative Gardner still, so for the record.
Thank you. But maybe by then you could tell us how many of the kids who do not graduate have IEPs or have had IEPs.
We can tell you that by the summit. We could probably tell you earlier.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Before we, I see a hand in the audience. Is it pertaining to what the commissioner spoke to?
Absolutely.
Okay, come forward, and while you're coming forward, I just want to say some of the legislators have other meetings that they have to attend, so that's why our numbers have cut down. All right, have a seat and state your name for the record, please. You sit there.
Okay. I didn't expect to be so formal for a couple of questions from the audience here, Commissioner, but on your meeting is coming up at the Dynina Center. Are you going to have it on camera so that we can all participate?
Would you state your name for the record, please?
Paul, middle initial D, Kendall.
We don't plan on doing that right now. We've talked about it, and there's nothing to prevent us. We have talked about trying to broadcast it statewide. We're doing a statewide survey prior to the summit that we're inviting citizens from all over Alaska to share, but you're suggesting that we actually videotape part of it and broadcast it live.
Well, yes, but I don't think I'm allowed to make suggestions. I have to form questions only. But my concern is that we continue to have these insider meetings, and it's becoming an infrastructure of our society. I'm seeing it in multiple sectors. But it's okay if you have the insider meetings, but you're obligated, I think, to put those on TV so we can all learn and come along together. And I think we're isolating our society by doing that. The other question was, do you have an itinerary or an agenda so we can see how you flow during the day? You're only going to be 2 days. You're going to bring 400 people together. Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated by your agenda because you can't get 40 people in a room. And without an agenda, it's very difficult to bring those to.
Well, I used to move around 500 or 800 high school kids, so I'm not really frightened about moving people around. But it does take careful thought, and when we send the invitations out, we will have a copy of the agenda. But the flow of people has been a real concern because one of the things that we want to do is provide maximum interaction among the participants. And so a lot of the work will be taking place in small groups. But I'm thinking that as we start presenting the plan, and it's always been our intent to post it once we finish the plan, to post it on the Internet and ask for public comment.
And then will there be a place for the audience to come and join your event but not participate, for example, to look into like a well or an audience seating so that we can see who our leaders are and how they're communicating and the problems they're facing?
Well, I think that's a great idea. I think the second day as we present, the draft plan, that would be an excellent time to invite the public to see what we're presenting. So I'll bring that to the group. It just, it makes a lot of sense.
Well, I'm fascinated by the second day, why that would have a stature of there, because I like to see things in the formation. And another question I would have is, I can't imagine not having energy as a matter of the discussion. It's absolutely essential. It's imperative. It's foundational. And without seeing your agenda and who's constructing that agenda, I guess, is that somewhere for the public to see, or is it being done by a select few, or is it who's participating and what your agenda is going to
be? Well, I don't know. You know, over 400 folk talking, you know, randomly invited is certainly not a select few, but it's our intent, you know, to collect information before the summit and to collect information following the summit and to process on it. I think you have some good suggestions in terms of the audience and the presentation of the plan. We haven't designed how we're going to communicate the collection of data, the correct way to get to Alaskans to, you know, participate in the web survey. We do know that we're creating a website. It should go up today that will be posting information. So I'm not really sure. As far as energy goes, you know, there's a lot of topics, and we haven't defined all the topics. We've identified major topics. We have 8 of them that we've identified. And under each of those are a number of possible subtopics, and we'll be training our facilitators ahead of time. Now, when groups get together, say we have a major group of 50 people that want to talk about early childhood, they will sub-break into other groups because early childhood is a complicated topic. With regard to energy, I can tell you as a former superintendent, you know, paying the bills is certainly a concern. But I don't know if that will be a chief topic of discussion.
Well, Mr. Kendall.
Yes.
We don't have time for any other questions. I think he's given you pretty much that they are in the planning stages, and some of the suggestions that you made, he's willing to look at those. You have other questions that you want to put into writing to him?
Well,
you may feel free to do that, but at this time we cannot continue to have you ask questions here.
Well, I only have one more if that's possible.
If you're very brief, I'll let you have your last question. It won't be much of a discussion on it, I'm sure.
I agree. And thank you so much for the compromise.
You're quite welcome.
Consultant. Anyway, well, are you going to have those people who would be some of your stiffest critics in the sense that you could assess the content of their criticisms? And sometimes in life those things work out best if we take our most ardent adversaries and bring them in our midst of view. And I don't know how I phrased that as a question, but I hope
he will deal with that. And thank you very much, Mr. Kimmel.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to go on with our next presentation at this time, so I'm going to ask Jennifer to come back and take center stage. And I want to thank the Commission of Education again for being here and speaking to you. And we'll move on to dropout.
Thank you. And I should mention here that really, in fact, dropout prevention and P16 are not at all two separate topics. They're very much interrelated. There are several P16 councils in the country that are looking specifically at dropout prevention as part of their agenda. If you go onto the ECS database on P16 and P20 councils, you can get more information about what these states are doing. And so I probably don't even need to put these first couple of slides into the presentation, but just to set the stage, I know that dropout is a huge issue nationwide. It was mentioned here, 4 out of 10 students nationwide. We're seeing 1 out of 3 high school students not completing with a high school diploma. And that counts out to about over 1.2 million students per year. And we're also seeing that male students tend to drop out at a higher rate than female students, and it goes across ethnic lines. So white females are more likely to graduate than white males. African-American females are more likely to graduate than African-American males, and so on and so forth. And I probably also don't need to mention here that there's a strong correlation between dropping out and various negative consequences for young people. Dropouts are more likely to be unemployed, to live near or at the federal poverty level. I think as of in the last year or so, the federal poverty level is about $19,100, and the average earning of a dropout in the U.S. was $1,907, something like that. So they're really living at the bottom there. Districts, the whole nation are losing tax revenues at all those levels, lost wages. And as you can see, among the local prison and state and federal prison population, a significant number of people in those systems are dropouts. And it also extends to various health and other related issues. You can see the chart here looks at Medicaid coverage, and there's a huge spike in terms of those who are dropouts, those who have some college, those who have graduated with a four-year degree or beyond. And clearly, Medicaid coverage is far higher among those who have not finished high school. There's also a clear link, not just in the U.S., but internationally. The more years that you complete of school, be it high school or post-secondary, the longer your life expectancy is. Welfare in terms of PAMP, food stamps, other types of welfare, you're much more likely to be on public assistance if you have not completed high school. And we also see higher teen pregnancy rates among high school dropouts. There was one study of recent dropouts that was published in 2006, and they found that 1 out of 4 of all dropouts and 1 out of 3 of female dropouts left school, at least in part because they become a parent. And I think that 1 out of 4 is where even males had left school because they now had a family to take care of and needed to go to work part or full time. And so recent research has really, just within the last few years, we know so much more than we did just a few years ago in terms of who's leaving school and what's causing students, what the correlations are between leaving school and various school or factor or individual components. And you probably have a copy of a purple report that came out, an ECS report that came out in July or August 2007, and it summarizes some of the research that I'm going to talk about today. In terms of on-track and grade 9, that's included in this study, and they looked at Chicago students, and they said the on-track was having completed at least 5 course credits, so you know, English, math, science, social studies, 1 other credit, to have enough credits to enter grade 10, and also earning no more than 1 semester F in English, math, science, or social studies. Another study that's also included in this research looked at as early as grade 6 in Philadelphia, and they found that they tracked students from grade 6 through a year or two after they were supposed to have graduated from high school, and they found that if students had any 4 indicators, if they had failed English, if they had failed math, if they had attendance at 80% or below, or if they had an out-of-school suspension, those students were significantly more likely, even 6 years before graduation, to eventually have left school before earning a high school diploma. And that if a student had a behavior incident, one of those behavior incidents, attendance or suspension, in addition to failing math or English, it spiked even higher. Those students were significantly more higher to eventually drop out of high school. Other research, there's a University of Michigan study that's also included in this purple report that looks at student-teacher relationships and how in schools where they surveyed students and teachers and a student responds saying, I know that my teacher cares about me and knows who I am, and a similar response for teachers, I know my students, and you know it's clear that other teachers in my building care about their students. Those students saw significantly, or those schools saw a significantly lower dropout rate than other high schools where survey responses were not so positive. And parental involvement, we talked a little bit earlier about the importance of parents setting high expectations and communicating those expectations to their high school age children. And I believe there was a report that was circulated that I brought one copy of with me today. School size, again, the same Michigan study talks about the importance of high schools and how it's more likely that you're going to have those strong connections between students and teachers if you have a smaller high school versus a larger high school. And then lastly, course taking, particularly in math, the kind of curriculum in math that the high school offers, and students' achievement in math is clearly indicated, correlated with a student's likelihood of graduating from high school. And so I'll walk through some of these different components.
There is a question. Would you hold on just a minute? Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My question is, just quickly, school size did make a difference, but where was the break off? What size?
I have the study with me. They said that large high schools between 1,500 and 2,500 had greater percentages of students dropping out, had a 12% dropout rate versus medium or very large schools. And the very large school really surprised the researchers, and they think that's because they were looking at dropouts at grades 11 and 12, and they hypothesized that at the very large schools above 2,500, students were leaving at grades 9 or 10, even before the study could catch them. But we found that smaller schools, 600 or fewer students, seem to have the stronger teacher-student relationships, and that the larger schools, that sort of relationship sort of died off a little bit.
And that sort of support the comment that, you know, we think that if our students are engaged and we are making sure that they have a significant other dealing with them, we could keep them in school longer.
Mm-hmm. And that actually touches on, are there any other questions? I also have another slide. It's surveys of recent dropouts. I have two sources here. One is the 2006 nationwide study that I mentioned earlier. And the other one was published by the Michigan Education Association in May of this year. And the findings of both of these studies were fairly similar. In the 2006 study, the dropouts, these were young people aged 16 to 25.
Mm-hmm.
And the top reason that they mentioned they left school because they found that school was boring. There was no relationship between what they were supposed to learn in school and what they thought they needed to do or know to get by in the real world. They said that this is the second most common reason, that their teachers, other people, adults did not expect them to work hard. They had low expectations of them, and students didn't feel inspired to put in much effort. And that two-thirds of them said that they would have put in more effort had more been expected of them. In the Michigan study in particular, a number of dropouts said that there was no job or career direction. They personally didn't know what they wanted to do after high school, and there was no adult guiding them, either a teacher or a counselor or some other type of adult. And so they felt that high school was pointless. There was no reason to finish high school. One-third of students or young adults in the 2006 study said that they're actually failing in school. They felt it was impossible for them to catch up, and that, so they decided, you know, why bother? I think over 50% of those in the 2006 study said that their parents were not proactively involved in their school, that they maybe are being contacted towards the end as attendance was kind of falling off the charts, but the parents didn't know it was too late, and in many cases, the parents' work schedule prevented them from being more involved in getting into the school and talking to teachers and so on. And then many students also, or young adults, cited that they simply had too much freedom. They said they knew that they were allowed to leave school when they were 16, so they were just waiting for their 16th birthday. They could walk out the door, and nobody could pull them in, you know, truancy officer or anyone else, pull them back into school. And so there's a whole variety of different responses. And these findings from the 2006 and 2008 study, they equal over 100% because students could name more than one reason, and in many cases, students did name more than one reason. It just wasn't one thing that caused them to decide to leave school.
Representative Wilson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I'm asking all these questions, but some schools, in some states, the age for that they can drop out is 16, and some 17, and some 18. Where did that make a difference?
I haven't seen a recent study in terms of graduation rates, and I think part of that is because states are changing the way that they calculate a graduate, and they're also putting into place more sophisticated data systems so that they know that the student is not just going to another district or going to an alternative program. They know that they've just fallen off the map, as it were. And also, in some states, the very definition of a graduate is changing. For example, until a couple of years ago, Texas was allowed to count GED completers as high school graduates. Well, there's a lot of research that suggests that in terms of completing a GED, you don't see the same outcomes in terms of post-secondary access and completion, income, et cetera, as when you have a high school diploma. And so now they're counting high school graduates separately from GED holders, and they're seeing their graduation rate go down because of that. In other states, they've changed the methodology. More states are going towards a four-year cohort of counting, so that they look at the students who enter in grade 9 and look at the people coming out 4 years later, as opposed to year by year, where it's a little bit less clear who's leaving and so on. And in fact, in some states, I'll talk about this later, in Nevada, they're now requiring dropout rates to be calculated at grade 6, 7, 8, so those kids who don't even get into high school are now being counted, as well as those who leave in grades 9 through 12. So it's much more difficult now to do longitudinal comparisons of graduation rate just because all these different factors that are coming into play. I don't know if that gets at your question or somewhat.
Okay. You may continue.
Thank you. And so I know this is a really wordy slide. I have to say that there's not one approach that states are taking in terms of addressing the dropout problem. It's really varied Some of these approaches do seem to be related to what the research says. Some of them are relatively new, and they're a little bit more anecdotal in terms of their impact or not. And in fact, I don't even have everything on the slide. I had to have a cutoff point at some point, and we talked about special education earlier. I know that there's a strong correlation between dropping out and students being identified for special education. Also, there's some research that suggests that a certain number of CTE, career technical education courses, may help keep students in school who may not have much of an interest in a traditional academic program. I didn't have time to get into that today, but I can tell you that ECS does have a 50-state database on career technical education programs. If you go to our ECS homepage and you go to the high school databases on the lower right side of the screen, you can go to our 2008 launched CTE, and it looks at some of the key indicators in terms of quality, in terms of measuring rigor in CTE courses, measuring teacher quality, career tech programs that tie the last years of high school to the first years of post-secondary, and so on. Another piece I have to say I don't have here today are adolescent literacy. I mentioned earlier that some dropouts said that they just felt so far behind, they felt like they were never going to catch up. And a small but growing number of states are looking at not stopping with literacy at grade three, but providing teachers and other adults in buildings with the skills they need to build upon students' literacy in grades 4 through 12. There's also an ECS database also launched in 2008 that looks at small adolescent literacy policies that are being implemented in the state. But anyway, here's what I have for today, and I know it's a huge brain dump at the end of a long day, but I'll try to briefly at least touch upon these, and then maybe during the question and answer section we can go through these in greater detail. So the first one, increasing rigor of the high school curriculum. This certainly gets at the research academically in terms of the math curriculum we talked about, and also what the dropouts themselves were saying in terms of students or teachers setting low expectations for them and students sort of falling under those low expectations. And so in at least 8 states, ECS has identified where all students are expected to complete a college/work-ready curriculum. And ECS is defining this in terms of 4 years of English, 3 years of social studies, 3 years of math and algebra 1, geometry, algebra 2 sequence, and 3 years of a lab science. And we chose this curriculum because it's in line with the college expectations that ACT has identified with those students who seem most prepared for college in terms of the courses they took to achieve a benchmark on the ACT score, ACT assessment, as well as research that was conducted by Cliff Edelman, who was at that time at the U.S. Department of Education. He found that students who completed this particular curriculum were most likely to complete high school and go on to a post-secondary institution and complete a 4-year degree within a reasonable amount of time. And only of these 8 states, only Texas has actually finished graduating a class with this particular curriculum. And I have to say, there is also an opt-out provision. I haven't seen, because it's just the class of 2008, I haven't seen statistics on the number of students who chose the lower level curriculum. That was an option statewide before the class of 2008. But the local efforts where a district has required a high level curriculum of all students are extremely encouraging. One example I've cited here is San Jose, California. It's a fairly large, extremely diverse district, diverse in terms of native student language, ethnicity, income, and so on. And starting, and this was from public support in 1999, the local board determined that all students would be expected to complete the curriculum that the California State University and University of California systems expect for basic admissions. That includes 4 years of English, 3 years of math, 2 years of foreign language, and so on. And a lot of critics said, no, you know, we can't expect some students to complete this curriculum. It's unfair. It's unreasonable. And in fact, the district saw the graduation rate increase rather than decrease. We also saw some other unexpected results, such as more Latino students completing advanced math and lab science courses. They saw the district the state level assessment scores for the district rise more quickly than those scores for the rest of the state. They saw more diverse students taking AP courses and passing the AP exam with a 3 or higher. You don't usually see an increase in number of students and an increase in the test scores, but that's what they saw in San Jose.
I have a question from Representative Sitner.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And my question would be, do you have a link that where we could actually see that that recommended improved curricula? Or not improved, but the one that is the kind of the higher standard.
Yeah.
Maybe you could later, but it'd be really great to have.
Yeah. Again, if you go to the ECS homepage, ecs.org, and then on the right-hand side, if you scroll down a little bit, there's a woman standing in front of a chalkboard, and it says something about ECS new high school databases. And then the page that takes you to, I believe it says something like college ready or college ready standards. And if you click on that, it'll take you to those states that have this sort of college work ready curriculum, Texas, which is class 2008, three states more in class 2010, and so on. It kind of snowballs from there, but also sets forth what this curriculum is that ECS decided on. And we also, on the ECS webpage, have a profile of San Jose, what they did in terms of preparing teachers for the advanced requirements, what some of the results have been, in addition to what I mentioned just now. And that same page, if you click on the woman in front of the chalkboard, there's a highlights of local initiatives database, and San Jose is one of the 12 highlights in that. And also, based on San Jose, the success of the San Jose experiment, Los Angeles Unified, one of the largest districts in the country, decided that effective with the class 2012, they too would require all students to complete this college-ready curriculum. And there's also a profile of Los Angeles, what they're doing in such a larger district to prepare for that. And now San Diego is starting to talk about what they would need to do in order to follow in the footsteps of San Jose and Los Angeles. And I should also mention the last point here, it has to be done right. It's not enough simply to just say, okay, we're going to have all these kids complete math, extra math and science courses. But if you look at the profiles, you can clearly see that teacher preparation and professional development are absolutely essential. Remediation support, so that even before grade 9, perhaps, students are ready to take Algebra 1 when they get to ninth grade. They're ready to take more advanced math or other science courses and so on. And also communicating, we're talking about parents, communicating to parents, you know, we're not ramming this down your kids' throats. They're going to be ready for work or college or whatever they choose much better than if they were taking a lower level curriculum. I was talking to some folks in the Department of Education in Michigan, and they're going from having virtually all locally set graduation requirements to a fairly rigorous statewide high school curriculum for the class 2011. And they were talking about how in the past, students who were taking Algebra 2 would self-select into this class. They were the very academically motivated students. They were able to study from a textbook and the teacher at the chalkboard. And now that all kids are going to be expected to take Algebra 2, teachers have to really rethink how they're teaching this course. It has to be more hands-on, more applied. They have to explain maybe in a little bit simpler language different math concepts than they were required to explain in the past. And so that professional development in Michigan has been really key in ramping up this new requirement. Another piece, student accountability. We talked about the number of states that require students to stay up until age 18. And in fact, it's just in recent years that some states, you see 20 states now, it was maybe 15 states 3 or 4 years ago. But it does get at that too much freedom that these dropouts were talking about. And there is some little research that was done by Princeton in the early 1990s looking at completion of high school and the age, I'm getting a little tongue-tied here, the age at which students turned 16, 17, 18, and they found that those students who were required to stay in high school until they were age 18 did end up having higher diploma attainment rates than those students who were able to leave before their age 18. There are other couple of student accountability pieces that do not have, per se, research support, but some anecdotal support. You know, pass the drive means that if a student is either below an attendance threshold or they fail X number of courses, they're unable to have a driver's license. 27 states have such policies, and then no pass, no play, where you're unable to participate in extracurricular activities if you're failing X number of courses and or do not meet an attendance threshold. Many of these policies were actually enacted in the late 80s or early 90s, but there's at least some indication because so few states have repealed such policies after they're put into place that something must be working, you know, somebody must be pleased with the results. But again, just anecdotally. Graduation plans and career majors. By graduation plan, these refer to where a student sits down with usually a parent and teacher or counselor, some other sort of adult in the building, at either grade 8 or the beginning of grade 9, and the student says, you know, I want to do this or that. once I finish high school, and then they walk through, okay, here are the courses you're going to have to take the 4 years of high school in order to meet this goal for yourself after high school. Not only is it course taking, but just starting to get students and parents thinking, like, what is it I want to do? What is going to give my high school experience meaning? And, again, these are fairly few states right now that have such requirements, just 9 states. But by the class 2011, there'll be 20 states plus the District of Columbia that'll have these types of counseling requirements. Also providing greater focus, academic focus, sort of getting students thinking about what they want to do, so-called career majors. They're called different things in different states. But just 3 or 4 states right now have these requirements where rather than taking 8 electives, you take maybe 4 general electives and maybe 3 or 4 courses in a specific area of interest. And it doesn't have to be the same area every year. Maybe year one, you're thinking, maybe I want to be an English teacher. By your sophomore year of high school, you want to become a music major. You know, you can change it year by year, but just getting a student to think about post-high school goals and taking courses that are in that area of focus.
Jennifer, I appreciate you going through each one of them and trying to give us the examples or tell us how it's working in some states. But since it's such a long list and you still have quite a ways to go, could you just run through them? You can call them off if there's someone have a question or something they want to ask. They can do that.
All right.
For the information, a lot of these things we already have information on or know how to get it.
Okay.
Or we could even get back with you. So if you don't have a problem with that,
no, not at all.
So that we can move right along. It's almost 3 o'clock.
Okay.
And you have a ways to go yet.
Yep. All right. Counseling. You might have heard of Georgia's graduation coaches program. Colorado enacted a new program to provide additional funds to put more counselors into high schools, especially those with higher than average dropout rates. Remediation. UCS launched an ECS database in 2007 and looks at, is the district required to offer, is the student required to attend remediation if they don't meet a certain threshold, and these various other indicators. And as I mentioned earlier, if students are falling behind, they need those supports. And oftentimes they're not provided or not evaluated if they are being provided. Early college high school, you may be familiar with this approach where you start a 5-year program beginning in grade 9. At the end of 5 years, you include an associate's degree, technical certification, or enough credits to enter college as a junior. There are only 6 states that actually have statewide policies. In other states where they have these local partnerships, they're governed either by dual enrollment or charter school rules, but they clearly have significant positive impacts on students. And it's particularly positive given that these programs are geared towards underserved students.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I have a question. Can you define underserved students?
Yes, and it really varies by district. Some states have tried to place these programs primarily in high minority districts, and others it may be in a Native American district or a district with a significant number of English language learners. In other districts, it may be just low-income students. But at any rate, it's students who are usually not considering themselves college material. They're not necessarily on a college path when they start high school. And I just mentioned the last bullet. Either in October or November, we're going to have a policy brief coming out that looks at, if you have state policies on early college high schools, here are the model policy components, and it'll draw from current legislation that's in North Carolina and some other states with model programs.
And that question was asked by Representative Gardner, for the record. I didn't call your name. You may continue.
As mentioned earlier, small learning communities where you break up a large high school into smaller groups, this is primarily something that's done at the local level rather than state policy level. But there are some states that are beginning to get into the fray. One example is Nevada. If it's a high school of more than 1,200 students, they must provide a separate learning community for grade 9. And I'll get into that a little bit later on when we talk about specific grade 9 initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
Florida requires districts to at least consider and encourages districts to develop schools within schools for large high schools. There's a policy brief. I brought one copy with me. I don't know if you have it in your packet or not. It's looking at, it's called Beyond the GED, State Strategies to Help Former Dropouts Earn a High School Diploma. And while we're talking about students who are maybe 16, 17, 18 and coming back to get a high school diploma, the strategies in this policy brief would also equally apply to students who are at risk, who don't seem to be doing well in the traditional high school. But this slide here looks at various sort of ways of providing flexibility so that students who are disengaged from high school, who aren't getting much out of their traditional program, can still complete the credits and get what they need to know to earn a regular high school diploma. At the middle grades, I mentioned that this purple study has a summary of a piece of research that was done on Philadelphia grade 6 indicators. Some states are now just beginning to look at the middle grades in terms of what needs to happen there for students to stay on track, be prepared for high school, not drop out. Oops. Sorry about that. We mentioned earlier parental involvement. You have a copy of the policy brief, and it sets out the various areas of policy under that third bullet. Ninth grade, as I mentioned, in Nevada, they have recent legislation that requires a separate area to be set up for ninth grade students in high schools over 1,200 students. They have to have at least one licensed administrator just dedicated to that small learning community. They have to assign guidance counselors just to that ninth grade community and have an adult mentor assigned to every ninth grader so that there is a connection between every young person and at least one adult in the building. And they also have to identify any as early as possible any needs for remediation counseling, so it's not at the end of ninth grade, it's not during 10th grade, that it's identified students low in English, math, what have you. And you can see in Louisiana, Rhode Island, for low-performing or districts with higher-than-average dropout rates, they one of the interventions that they must choose from would be identifying students at risk of failing any ninth grade math. And one of the last, oh, sorry.
That is some valuable information, and I'd like for you to see that we get copies of that. We have it in our package, just the topic.
Yeah, I'd be happy to send you the legislation in all three of these states that looks at what. Yeah.
Right.
I think this may be one of the last state policy approaches. It's a very new one, to be honest. In Oregon, they have a dual enrollment program called Expanded Options, and the statute specifies that districts must make it a priority to identify or to inform dropouts of the availability of expanded options. And if a student has dropped out, they must let them back into the system to participate in this particular dual enrollment program. In addition, the state must report annually on the number of dropouts who participated in expanded options and then ultimately earned a high school diploma. In Rhode Island, this must be an option set forth for districts with a dropout rate above 15%. And Indiana provides what's called Fast Track to College, and this allows students who are either age 17 and have the permission of their high school, who may be at risk, or who are age 19 or older and have left high school, to finish their high school diploma at a community college or four-year institution and concurrently earn high school credits plus post-secondary credits. I have to say one of the disadvantages talking to Indiana staff is that for those who are age 19 or older and who don't have a high school diploma, they're not eligible for federal financial aid, so they have to bear their own costs of tuition, fees, and so on. And so because of that, they're seeing relatively few 19 or older students participating, but they hope to address that.
Except there are some states that are able to subsidize that for them.
Yeah. Oregon does actually, I believe, provide some funds. And I think that the Oregon program is mentioned in this Beyond the GED policy brief. And again, this policy brief, Beyond the GED, looks at dropout recovery, how to get older dropouts back in so they earn a regular high school diploma. And the policy brief goes through all of these different pieces you see here. That's the conclusion of my presentation.
That's the conclusion?
It's my prepared comments. I'd be happy to take any questions you may have.
Okay. Are there any questions at this point?
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. If you go back when you're talking about dual enrollment in Oregon, mm-hmm. priority for districts to inform dropouts of expanded options. Can you talk a little bit more about what the expanded options are?
Yes, it's a program for traditionally students in grades 11, 12 that they make to take courses at a post-secondary campus and earn high school and post-secondary credits.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? We at this time are ready for our audience. If you have any questions concerning to the information that was provided to us on dropout, we can take those at this time. And we are at 3 o'clock. I don't have anybody that signed up on here that says they have any comments that they want to make, but I do want to give the Commissioner of Education an opportunity if he wanted to speak to this
particular topic, we could have him come up at this time. Is there anybody else that want to speak to the dropout? You got your hand up, Finn? You want to speak to the dropout? Yeah, you may ask questions of her pertaining to dropout. I have that. We will get to that at 4 o'clock. Other comments will be made at 4. We are addressing dropout only at this time.
Question from Sitka.
Would you repeat? I didn't hear you.
This is Karen Martinson. I have a question from Sitka.
All right, Sharon, would you ask your question?
Yes, I'm wondering if you have information about the impact of career and technical ed as a dropout prevention strategy.
I have seen a little bit of research on that. I can't remember who authored the particular study, but they were looking at students who completed, I'll just say for the sake of argument, between 1 and 12 credits in a career technical program, and they found that those at-risk students who were in the middle ground in terms of completing those career technical programs, who, for example, said completed 6 credits, were most likely to graduate in terms of their peers who were also identified as at risk. But once the balance was thrown off, when there are more CTE courses completed than academic among these at-risk students, then the dropout rate actually increased rather than decreased. They talked about sort of a golden ratio of CTE versus academic for at-risk students. I could probably track down that study and email it to you if you'd like to see it.
Karen?
That would be great. Thanks so much.
Well, who are you affiliated with?
I am the director of the Southeast Alaska Career Center with the Sitka School District.
All right, that would be good for our record. Sharon Sister, Representative Sister.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, could I ask that that also that specific reference be sent to us as well.
Okay.
That would be a good one. Thank you.
Great. That would be.
And the person on the phone, would you be able to send me your email address and I can reply with the study?
Yes, I'd be happy to. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? I see it. And is this pertaining to the dropout? Well, come forward.
I'm used to the location where you just yell out something from the back room there.
Middle initial Paul D. Kendall. I've been coming and going, and I apologize if I missed this data, Ms. Donday. Is there anything in here about the parents as far as their ages, how long they've been married, number of children in the family, socioeconomic background, and I have other questions along that line.
I don't have any specific I haven't looked into that particular issue. I know that there is some research that suggests that students from single-parent homes are more likely to drop out than those from two-parent homes, but I couldn't tell you where exactly I've seen that before, but I have seen that figure there.
Do you have other questions? I'm trying to phrase this. I'm so used to propounding things. Are you bringing those studies forward and looking at the child? And do you find that of relevance? Not only the parental and the point of birth and the society which they grow, but some of the teachers who are being brought in. I would think that I have watched the comments here. Is there teacher data so where those teachers come from, a predisposition for a sexual orientation or diversity of background? I don't see anything in here in that way, and if it is there, I'd sure like to see that.
So correlating which students are dropping out to which teachers they have?
Well, I'm trying to see just how much information I've seen all this before. I'm an older male. I've seen the same data, just it's been chunked and churned many different ways. But I was curious as looking at the family because my concern is about the child and the parental raising, and not only that, but whoever influences the child, that most direct influence is the teacher after the parents. And I would think you would be looking, assessing the teacher's inclinations for many different perspectives.
Some states are beginning to develop data systems that also have teacher identifiers so that you can track which students have had which teachers, but those states are relatively few at this point, and I'm not sure there aren't enough years of data to definitively, you know, say one way or another.
And my last question would be not just the disposition, any information on the disposition of the family in the marriage, whether it's the first or second marriage, number of children in that family, are you also tracking any drugs or violence or social services or things like that that child comes from? And I guess that's my final question, Ms. Davis. I'll sit down. Thank you.
Yeah, ECS has not personally, as an organization, have not tracked this, and if there are other organizations that have, I'm just not familiar with that research at this time.
All right, thank you very much. I want to also say that we have Representative Faircross who has joined us. If you have a comment or statement you want to make or say anything at this point, we do have the time. We're running more than on time, so you have the opportunity.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for being late. The schedule had changed several times, and I had accepted a speaking engagement out in Eagle River. But our office is following. Senator Dyson's office is online listening. So just because you don't see attendance here doesn't mean that other members aren't participating.
Yeah, we have recognized those on net, off net that we know about. I haven't received another list, but glad to know that Senator Dyson is online also. And if I get a list, I'll recognize anybody else that's there. Representative Sitna?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess since, in fact, I don't think I'm that there's any discouragement of questions here, one of the things that I know is an issue in Alaska, and you're talking about the national scene, but here in Alaska we have certain conditions that really are, in studies on our health, appear to be chronic to our state, but unusual. And one is kind of the itinerancy of our population, the fact that we have a large population, percentage-wise, that go certain places to work for seasons and then go. And I think it affects their kids, too, that their kids come with. And it would be interesting to know if you have run across in other parts of the country, in states where there might be seasonal jobs, and some of the states that have things like agricultural kinds of things might fit into that. If there's been any correlation there with dropouts and how groups may have addressed that.
I've seen some research, and I don't think it was particularly towards itinerant workers, but just the number of times that a child changed schools during their K-12 career, and that there was a correlation between lower likelihood of completing high school after a certain threshold of changing schools. But it's been a while since I saw that. I couldn't tell you any more specifics about that piece of research. But in terms of also addressing the migrant worker, I'm afraid I haven't really looked particularly at that issue, but I could do some additional research for you if you'd like.
Thank you. That would be, I think it'd be helpful to our communities here in Alaska.
Okay, Representative Faircloth?
Thank you, Madam Chair. If this has been gone over, I believe if someone's late, you don't need to go back over and rehash it. But the reason that it was important for me to come, even though I was late, is this issue was very important to me when I served locally in an elementary school on the PTA. And we looked at dropout rates when I also served on the Anchorage Assembly. And so I was wondering, while this appears to look at ninth grade and up, if there's research that you've done regarding attendance at lower levels, because what I did when I was serving on the assembly was actually talk to the school nurses. And the school nurses could identify who was going to be a bully in ninth grade as well as who would be most likely to drop out just by being ill-equipped to handle current class load assignments as young as first grade, second grade, and third grade. And so if we were going to invest resources, it seemed to me as a parent, at least, I am not studied in this, and I don't know if research supports it, but do you have any kind of relationships or studies that you're pointing to where we could intervene at an earlier level than waiting for intervention up in high school? Because from what I had read, we needed to go much younger into getting them prepared.
Yeah, in fact, in this, the purple handout, there is a study that looks at grade six. It's in the middle. It's looking at grade six indicators. And I've heard of some research even looks, again, at the early the elementary grades. There's one study, ECLS have a research studies database where they synthesize for policymakers. It's jargon-free. I think there's a 2001 study. It's ecs.org/RS for research studies. If you go to the FAQ section on dropout, it's a thing in the title about life course factors. I can't remember the full title, but I think that may look at the early grades. So.
There's lots of information out there.
Thank you.
On this. Yes. Any other questions? I see your hand, Mr. Kendall, but I'm going to give other people an opportunity to speak if they need to. I know there was some people in the audience that said they had to pick children up. If there's anybody still here and want to make a comment, I would give you the opportunity to come forward now. And also, I want the commissioner to have an opportunity to speak as we address this. I know it's going to come up in the summit, but he might have some comments to make now that he's heard the presentation from Jennifer.
Thank you, Senator Davis.
You're welcome.
Just a couple of quick comments. Just to let you know a little bit of my background. I was a high school principal for 10 years and also an elementary preschool through sixth grade principal for 10 years. So some of these comments I'm going to make are based on working with youngsters.
Maybe you need to come here if that's not convenient. Thank you.
I will be very brief. I would say that if you want to find out what's going on in a child's life, all you have to do is ask them what they're going to do next year, where they're going to go to tech school, what they're going to do this summer. And a child who's at risk will always say, I don't know. The most important characteristic of a teenager is that they have no vision. They don't know where they're going. They have no plan. They've never connected, and it's easy to do. As an elementary principal, for that long, I've watched my little ones go through the system, and you can identify them much earlier than sixth grade. I think most elementary principals, if they've been there long enough, can see these youngsters. Those characteristics are there. Not labels, you just see the signs, and they seem to bear fruit later on with these kids. Probably one of the most important things I would say about dropouts is to keep in mind is that a child will pay any price to belong, any price to belong, to feel connected. And many kids that leave school are not connected. And I can tell you how important it is, because if I ask you who that important teacher was in your life, it won't be the one who was the best lecturer. It'll probably be somebody that connected with you in some way and made you feel special. And schools aren't always able to do that. Just a couple of real quick things. Technology, when I talked earlier, that kids are learning in real time. And I think that I was talking to some representatives of the Heart Association. They were saying, we want a PE credit, mandatory. And I said, okay. But what if a student can show that they already have accomplished everything with that credit? Do you still want them to give up an elective? What is the outcome of taking a credit? Because right now, and they said, well, we don't know. And I said, what if they got a class in ping pong? Would that meet a PE credit? What do you want them to know and be able to do by taking this credit? And when you look at education from a broad perspective, why do we want a student to sit in a class, in a U.S. history class, for a year, when perhaps there's a way for them to demonstrate that they have obtained all of that knowledge earlier? Kids are learning faster, and we're looking at outcomes, and yet many times we're still forcing kids to sit in these seats and learn according to our schedule, as if seat time is part of learning instead of mastery. And so that's one of the things we have to change. In many of our schools in Alaska, the playground has gotten very small. Kids should have a large playground to explore their talents, their interests, to take risks, to do those things. And if you look at many of the schedules in school, because of budgets and because of an emphasis on remediation, kids don't have the choices that they used to have even when I was in school. In a smaller high school, they don't have those choices. And when they can walk with their feet, that's important. So we need to increase that playground. Also, Many of us are people my age, and I graduated in 1972. Everybody got a job. We all got part-time jobs, and we learned very important skills to help us be successful in life. But it's hard for kids to find those jobs. I used to say in Kodiak, where do 1,500 kids get a part-time job in Kodiak? They don't. So they don't learn those skills. And so if they don't have them, that affects it. So I will also say in Alaska, part of our dropout rate is in rural education. Although it's happening here, we see a flight of kids from rural Alaska that's been taking place for the last 10 years. And what's happened is when the Malahooch Consent Decree came forth and we built these schools, many of the schools were much bigger. They had vocational programs. If you go to most rural high schools, they'll have a vocational room. They had enough kids to have a certain degree of expertise, but they don't anymore. And the kids at these small schools, we have 100 schools, you know, 25 or 100, while they're home, they can't always get the quality of program that they want to explore their interests. Career and technology, many of their classes are not taught by teachers that have that expertise. And so some of them and their parents will choose to go to a larger high school. But even there, then we're back to the law of connections. If they don't feel connected when they come into that school, they become invisible and they disappear. So what I'm trying to say is that everything that you had up there makes a lot of sense. It really does. In Alaska, I will tell you, are doing many of those things. Right now we're exploring, I call them middle colleges. I'm not sure what you call them up there, where we're looking to develop sites where kids could get their associate's degree the same time they get their high school diploma. And these are not, I've got sites ready to go right now. This is an intimate partnership. And these aren't elitist programs. These are programs that just draw kids and make them want to be there. And the last thing I will say, and I said it before, many of the kids that are walking away, they have skills. They're just not connected. They don't have the vision. They don't have that ability to make connections with the society that's changing. So,
thank you very much. There is a question from Representative Sissner.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Yes, my question of our presenters simultaneously here is that it is true that Alaska has a population that moves around. It moves between communities, seasonal jobs, other things that keep people moving back and forth. And it's killing us, I think, personally, to not be able to have those kids getting through school. It will put us in third world country, in some places we already are in third world country, and it'll put the rest of us there unless we address it. The thing I remember was when I started in the early 2000s, there was some training of rural teachers on how to use the internet effectively so that it would be possible in rural Alaska to keep kids right at the same level as anywhere in the world. You could if you used it and had really good instruction. You'd be able to stay in sync. And I think that's true with distance delivery that's being done at the university level. I know some of the people that I'm talking with that are taking classes now are able to use the internet in ways that are really keeping people engaged and moving forward. If we have a very itinerant population that are moving around, can't we figure out a way to utilize something like the internet to keep us, keep these kids engaged, even though they may be many places? I mean, there must be a way to do this. And is something like that being done anywhere?
There are a number of states that either through a virtual high school or through other types of programs, Alabama and Louisiana are two examples I can think of, that have where, for example, maybe I didn't do so well or I didn't finish a math course when I take the credit recovery. It has to be targeted just at the skills that I was deficient in, and it has to be self-paced, not so, like you were saying, not having to sit through an entire year just because I didn't get a few key pieces of information. And it has to be at the same standard as the regular state set standards, not watered down, not at a lower level.
We are looking. Some of the things we did with technology initially just sort of looked like the old thing with technology, and it wasn't as successful. There are some virtual high school models we're looking at, and currently we're exploring a high school master schedule that teachers could join together to post classes, real live classes with real teachers at different times, a consortium. So a teacher in Carlick that may have one high school student can pull up a virtual schedule and have over 200 classes with real teachers that they could sign up for, that sort of a partnership that we're exploring. We're at the very start, but we're at that age in the virtual high school, and as we go to more of a standards-based system where instead of the credit, it's the what you actually learn that is critical. And once we come to that conclusion, we won't force kids to go through a whole course to make up a, perhaps an F that they got, but to measure what they need to know to accomplish the standards we have. Once they accomplish it, they go on to their next task. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're moving in that direction with credit recovery, virtual schedules,
right,
and very, very flexible ways for kids to earn credit.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Is there anybody off net that have a question or a comment? You're not. We're going to take a 5 minutes break, and then we're going to come back. And if you have questions that you want to ask individuals, it's a good opportunity to do that now. I'll visit with some of the people that's out in the audience. We'll come back in about 5 minutes. Make a statement or testify, and they will probably talk us into 4 o'clock, and there might be others phoning in for testimony. Okay, we're back on record here. And I'm going to make Mr. Kendall last, because I know he's going to have more questions and comments than others. And he will wait and give his testimony at the 4 o'clock. Paula, you still in the room. You may come first, since you've changed your no to a yes.
I did.
And I need you to state your name for the record.
Paula Pulowski.
You represent?
Alaska PTA as legislative chair.
Yes.
I'm sorry there aren't more parents in the audience, as they're at work, and
yes,
I have a liberal schedule, so that's why I usually end up here with you. I first would like to thank you for having this discussion and opening it to the public. I think that's very generous and helpful for all. Then I just won't have to repeat myself later. NCES is one of my favorite research groups. I think I would like to give you a little background, because not everyone knows who I am or where I come from. And I was born here in Alaska, and then when my mother married, we became a military family. And between the grades of 1 and 12, I had 9 states and 11 schools, and a lot of different school systems, and a lot of different ways to be educated. So many ways, in fact, that my personal SAT scores were in the basement. There were some subjects I never had in school. For instance, biology versus geology. Every time I moved, I happened to be in the semester that they were teaching geology. So when I came as a senior and I had to pass a biology class, I took it twice, And there were other subjects like that. So if you're not, and we're talking a little bit here today about transient students, if someone is not tracking what they're taking and when they're taking it and having that checkoff list, you can get very lost. I have three children of my own. It's hard to believe that the eldest is now 36. Some of you know my oldest son, Michael, and my youngest son, David. We've also, as a family, had three exchange students from Costa Rica, Japan, and Switzerland. And then Michael spent a year in Sweden afterwards. My youngest son has spent a year and a half in China, a year in Taiwan, and now he's in Stanford while his wife gets her doctorate. So we've had many school systems, Europe, Asia, South America, and well as I've been exposed. So I have made a couple of points that I'd really like to state here. I thought the first slide was phenomenal. Everyone is pointing their finger at the parents. What are you doing about the education? And the fact of the matter is there are so many parents that are not teachers, and they don't realize the power that they have to be teachers. But they do know their child best, and they are their child's first educator, whether that's negative or positive. You can be a negative influence on your child as a parent as well as a positive influence. And just a little history for Alaska, in about 1995, the Alaska State Board of Education, and it won't surprise you that Abby Hensley at that time was the state PTA president and sat on the State Board of Education, that the state board endorsed the standards for parent involvement developed by Johns Hopkins University, Dr. Joyce Epstein. Dr. Joyce Epstein then worked with National PTA to continue to develop those standards. It also will not surprise you that as I was state PTA president in 97 and 99, and also spent 5 years on the State Board of Education, PTA has a habit of doing that, we endorsed the printed book of the national standards, which between 95 and 2000 was not available. And National PTA worked with Johns Hopkins to do that. So the state of Alaska has two opportunities to define parent involvement by using those standards. Those standards have quality indicators, so you know what it looks like. They have measurement tools already in place. And so far, the State Department of Education has not utilized those standards to define and look at what parent involvement can do for students and partnerships. Fairbanks Borough has done an excellent job. If you go to their website, they are using the standards, as was indicated in No Child Left Behind, to define a parent involvement policy. The rest of the state is way behind on that. PTA is an organized entity, and thank you for stating your ability to be a partner in PTA, because it is a very educational experience for parents. At the moment, there are over 9,000 members in the state. Not only are we organized, but I commented yesterday that Anchorage has only two PTAs at the high school level. So while the research will tell you what parents want at the secondary level, PTA at the secondary level doesn't look the same as elementary level. They're completely different looking. But the parents at the secondary level, according to Johns Hopkins, wants information about jobs, wants information about career paths. They do not want their children living at home when they're 32. They want these children to be successful. But with only two organized PTAs in Anchorage, we as a state PTA do not have a vehicle of giving information and getting information to those parents. And so that's something that we always need to watch. We have about 158 PTAs across the state. We requested funding for a parent involvement project for the last 2 years from the legislature, and I would again like to thank you for all your support, because it went through the House, went through the Senate, and then was vetoed. So there were a couple of things that were important in that project that we wanted to fund. Part of it was to spread PTA to more rural areas that we as volunteers don't have the money to do. The other one was a teacher preparation class, because there is no teacher preparation parent involvement 101 at the university level. And in fact, when I was on the State Board of Ed, the university was dragging their feet to have their teacher preparation program become NCATE standardized or recognized by the NCATE standardization. Parent involvement, they say, is buried in every class that we teach. I go, really? Anybody know how to do a parent-teacher conference as a brand-new teacher? It can be a scary thing on both parts. There are some standard things that the PTA wanted to embed in that particular teacher preparation class, but it went by the wayside of no funding available. It would not surprise you that some of the worker bees that are stated as sources in the materials that you got today mentioned Karen Mapp and Ann Henderson. Last year, National PTA had a contract with Ann Henderson to realign all of our information and resources on the National Parent Standards. So National PTA has been working with her. I'd like you to know that that connection is there. I have a new job in the last 4 months as director for Bridge Builders of Anchorage, and I am looking at that group of parents, that very diverse parents have no clue how to navigate the school system. I thought parents as a regular parent had no idea how to do it. But I do have to tell you that parents of minority communities, the child is acting as the communicator between school and family. And that's not going down so well for parents. So I think what you do here and what the state does will also, I will be asking for help to reach our communities in what it is that you do next. The next point is, because we're an organized state PTA in this state, I have the ability, which I promise I will do before the November summit, is I will be contacting all state PTA presidents and asking, what does this look like in your world? We have the research, we have models, but I will be asking those state PTA presidents to give us that information. How is it working for parents in your state? And I can engage that with one simple email to every state president and Europe presidents, as well as our legislative liaison at National PTA. That's the magic of connectivity, is that we can get that information on the real world, and I will be glad to do that. I appreciate Commissioner Ledoux promising that the PTA will be invited to the table at the November conference. Just a couple more things I have to say to you.
Go right ahead.
thanks. Let me see, because I made the notes here. I also would like to state that, along with Commissioner Ledoux, who used the word communication, this is the way I presented in family workshops, is that if you have a good family and you have a poor teaching experience, the child will still be okay. If you have a poor family experience, which was mine, and you have great teachers, that child will be fine. But when you have a poor family situation and a poor teaching situation, that is a child who's disconnected. I have to tell you that both as a child and as a parent, I can tell you the teachers at West High that molded my kids. I can see the impression on their faces. I hear it in their voices. I hear it in the way they view the world. And you could not find a prouder parent of three children who went to West High School. And I also occurred to me in my brain that we also were always the smallest attendance of all the high schools in Anchorage. And I truly believe that smaller communities allow a child to be better connected. So the last thing I would just like to say to you, I think, is that there is some great research out there. There was the question on family tracking. There's a piece of information on the Fatherhood Project that was a national research-based movement to engage fathers. There's lots of research on non-custodial fathers being involved with their children and how successful they are. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to know if you have a non-custodial parent who is not in that child's life, it affects their learning. It also should not surprise you that non-custodial parents or single fathers who are engaged in their child's education life, the statistics are the same as having both current parents at home. So, you know, it's the intent and the engagement of the parent, and how do we make sure that those parents and those fathers and non-fathers and stepfathers and grandfathers are all involved. It's not really a difficult thing to know how to do that. And my favorite piece of reading material from NCES is it's great research, and I think it's on how do parents and schools agree. And to me is the most humorous research I have ever read in my entire life, because the question was, how many of you attend your child's parent-teacher conference? And the parents said no. And the schools were asked, how many of your parents attend parent-teacher conferences? And the answer was no. And then there was another question of how many parents attend other events. They said yes. The teacher said no. In some cases, there is a variety of percentage points of up to 45% difference. I'm like, oh, my gosh, if we cannot even agree on parents do attend, parents don't attend, from opposite views, we can't even reach the middle. The problem is that parents answered, do you attend your child's parent-teacher conference, with a no answer, is because that community did not have parent-teacher conferences at the secondary level at all. So the numbers that you're getting are already skewed. If you don't have the availability of a parent-teacher conference, how are you going to attend it and answer that question yes? So one of the things that PTA really is not fond of is what we call the body count. How many parents attended a sporting event? How many parents attended a teacher conference? How many came to check on their kid for whatever reason? And part of that is because the way the parents have changed themselves. In downturn economic times, as it is today, you have more and more dual parents working just to keep the food on the table. And they feel very strongly that the educators are the experts. If they wanted to be a teacher, they would have gone to school to be a teacher. They would have been in the education mode. But if I want to be a scientist, or as my husband was active duty in fisheries research, then he's not a teacher. And so we have to remember that we both are teachers within our own right, and how do we meet and support that child? And I can tell you, quite frankly, that's why I like the standards, because much of the standards, the learning at home piece, is vital. As a military family, my kids have been through every state in the union, including Hawaii. And the things they have seen really create sort of a nightmare situation for the history teacher, because they have been there, done that, seen it. And so when Michael is asked, what do you think of Colonel Custer's battle, he will tell you, because he stood on the battlefield. So there are things that I can create at home that nobody else can create. And so we have to empower the parents to let them do that and encourage them to do it. And, yes, there are the basic needs of getting your child to school on time, well-fed, well-rested, and ready to do their homework. That is a parent who's working at home to support education. That may be the only thing they can do, or they can do things like we've done, take them museums, libraries, you know, things outside the classroom that will affect their learning. So I think that sort of wraps up, but I did want to tell you that there is a history in Alaska of being a Johns Hopkins partnership school, which uses the standards to engage parents. There are very few of our districts that have developed parent involvement policies that engage those standards for parent involvement. And that was the goal, and still is the goal, of the Alaska PTA, is to have people actually use those standards. Why? Because it's definition, it's quality indicators. And that is the most difficult thing on how to describe parent involvement. What does it look like? How does it act? What's the end result? So if we can go back to what we've adopted already and not go mess with a whole lot of other things, those six standards will cover business, home, at school. And that is the language that's in No Child Left Behind. It should not surprise you that National PTA worked very hard to get that language in No Child Left Behind. Questions?
Thank you for your comments. Are there any questions? Yes.
Thank you. Just briefly.
Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said there are 153 PTAs in Alaska. Have you seen the numbers change in terms of the percentage of schools, say in Anchorage, in an urban area, that have PTAs?
Yes, we have. And because PTA is a volunteer job, both at the local level and the national president is a volunteer, it is directly driven by people that have time to do that. And so some years, I'll tell you truthfully, some years we have as few as 135 PTAs in the state, and then we've had as many as 180. because when something is critical, parents will come together to move it forward and to protect it, and then they will reactivate their PTA status because in the state office we keep track of that. They have to have insurance, they have to have board members, and there's a whole list of things that we require they have to be a PTA in good standing. So when they go inactive because there's nobody to run it, we advise folks to let it go inactive. Do not resurrect it until you have people ready to work on it, because one person cannot be the PTA. So it comes and it goes, and all we do is reactivate their charter.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
for your
you,
comment.
And thank you for the meeting.
All righty. We're going to ask Mr. Rogers to come up. He represents the State Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you, Senator, and thank you all for having me here today.
Thank you. You're welcome.
My name is Andy Rogers. I am, first and foremost, I'm a proud father and a parent, but today I'm here as the CEO of Pango Media Corporation, and we're a local software engineering firm, and specifically as a representative of the State Chamber as a member of the Legislative Affairs Committee. As a representative of industry and primarily concerned with workforce preparedness, I'm on the P to 16 scale, kind of mostly interested in the 13 to 16 portion of that. What I would like to comment on today, and hopefully fairly briefly, is some concerns of industry in regards to the education and completion of education for our future and potential workforces, and a request and a challenge from industry to the people in this room, the people who may be calling in, and anyone you may work with for the betterment of our education system. First and foremost, our interest, and I'll speak specifically for me, my interest is in seeing students complete courses of study and then entering the workforce as employable young professionals. There's an old and tired cliche that you need the job to get the experience, you need the experience to get the job. And someone commented earlier, in Kodiak, what do you do with 1,500 students when they graduate high school? How do you find them a part-time job? I think you could extend that, and if you had 1,500 recent college graduates, where would you find them a full-time job? It's a very, very difficult thing to do. It's difficult for industry to grow when students attempt to enter the workforce without the necessary resume to actually be successfully placed in profitable positions for industry. And I think it's also a disservice to students, a disservice inflicted by whatever finger pointing your slide may warrant, but it's a disservice to students if they go through an educational process and are essentially in the the first blush of establishing their personal and professional networks, and then enter a workforce with an inadequate resume to find employment, and they're faced with either a dissatisfactory work outside of their chosen career field, or worse, even a relocation away from all the effort they put into it, those burgeoning networks. Given that difficulty suffered by industry and that disservice to students, I would request that that in the educational process, there be an emphasis on internships in the actual workforce, so that when a student does leave the educational process and try to start their professional career, they have some demonstrable skills and they have some experience in outside of classroom learning. Like this is when you pay for the check if your boss takes you to work. It's somewhat ridiculous. Sometimes what we see people come to us armed with is as suitable knowledge for entry into the workforce. I'd request that the educational institutions be encouraged to connect more directly with industry and with representatives from the business world, and make additional efforts to include pragmatic work experience in their students' education. And lastly, I would like to request that members from the business community be included, further included, in discussions of this nature when trying to craft the best educational system possible for our young students. One of the most discouraging things as a local employer that we see is we don't get our best and our brightest entering our own post-secondary institutions up here in Alaska. They leave and they start to establish, you know, the first time out on their own, they start to establish those early ties with friends, you know, perhaps find a spouse and marry them. You know, your first business ties are often the people at your place of higher learning, your professors and whatnot. They establish that network there, and we don't get them back. Or if they finish I'm a UA alum, and so is my wife, and thank goodness we both continued our professional lives here and can raise our children here. But a lot of times when we do manage to hang on to our students or import a few from outside states, they go through our educational system, our post-secondary educational system, I should say, and then we can't find work for them. And heaven forbid they need to relocate and abandon the work they've done, establishing themselves here as young adults, and then we don't get them back after that.
Are there any questions, Mr. Rogers? I guess not, but we really thank you for your comments, and we definitely want the business to be involved with the education process.
Thank you.
And I'm sure that you'll participate in the summit and many other things that's going to come up, the P16 Council or whatever we decide to go in what direction, and want to hear your comments and hope you participate at all levels.
Please,
thank you very much.
Let myself know, and just the state chamber at large is very, very interested in making this a legislative priority as well.
All right. Thank you very much.
You.
Is there anyone else? The last person that I have on my list is Mr. Kendall, and I'm going to have him come forward. Is there anybody on the line that wants to testify? Off net? Come forward, Mr. Kendall.
Sure, I'd like to give you a copy of my energy plan. On top of that, there's pages attached.
All right, thank you.
I was chewing out Mr.
Haggison.
I think I do on a regular basis now.
I'll see that it gets copied for others then.
All right. And make no heed to my chewing out Mr. Haggison. He accommodates that on a regular basis, and I thank him for his his accommodating me to do that. My name is Paul, middle initial D, Kendall. I fundamentally think the school system is flawed. I'm very concerned about it, but whenever I hear people mention or give testimony they have a passion for something, it just puts me back in my place, because those people who have a passion for something and a commitment to it, I think they have a greater standing than people like me who look at something from the outside and would chastise you. Just if I might briefly, I think you've gone way beyond your mission. You've now got groups looking at groups, and this isn't complicated. You need to get back to the home, to the mother and the father and that child. And I was a child. I speak from some memories as a child that was challenged in some ways. And I just can't. You can't. If you're going to look at that child, you need to look at the home from which it comes. And if you don't look at the home from which that child comes, then you can't look at the child, in my opinion. And you're not a university. You're not here to do work employment. You're here to teach that child how to learn and learn to live with other children and help him transition. And so no matter where he goes, he'll be able to love and to learn, to get along. And somehow you've morphed yourselves into more than it's scary for me, and I like to think I can handle big thoughts. And so anyway, I think it's real simple. You need to get back to your job at hand, and the child that can't be handled needs to be sent home. Society takes care of him, and that child that manages to go past the others, he should be rewarded, and that's just the way it is. Nature does that, and we do that, and the insects do that, and that's pretty much it.
Now, if I might just set that aside for a moment, thank you for having the meeting today. And I came here to kind of ambush you, put my discontent on record and ambush you with another mission. In doing that, it's nice to see such strong people because I feel your presence and commitments. And I just met Mr. Ledoux, and he seems like a nice person and a very capable person. I came to ask you to turn your efforts towards energy. I just can't, they first look at energy and think, well, what in the world has that got to do with this? And from what I'm seeing out there, everything in Alaska should be directed towards energy. All funding, all projects for capitalization should be stopped right now and everybody turn and look together in a herd-like mentality. It is the energy which allows you to sustain your society. It is that energy, and I think you folks have heard me before, that holds the dwelling together. It is that energy that gives you a sense of comfort. It gives you a sense of boundaries. And if you look at what's happening out there in our society today, there's no terra firma. There's no firm ground. There's no port. The values are being skewed. The identities are being skewed. There's diversity and gender and political correctness and the overseas and the new world order. And when you look at that, it drives me back to my old days, and that was that when I was a young man, my neighbor could do anything. He could sit there and get drunk all day. We didn't care because he had an abundance. It was an abundant life, and he had energy. But if he wanted to be a doctor, he could strive harder to do that, or if he wanted to be a writer. And then it dawned on me, well, what happened there was each of us had a certain amount of energy, and that energy provided us a sense of security. And somehow we lost that. Now there's no safe home for that child who wants to sit there and read all day, or if he wants to play with the cat, he can't do that. And likewise, his parents. They are being driven. It's almost a form of economic subjugation, from what I can tell, because we've conveyed to these people energy. And that energy is perturbing everything in our society, everything. And when you look out across the land, all the creatures, the plants, what you call the environment, they're all energy connected. Every single one of them, whether it's a plant or even there's some theories about rocks even. The point is it's about the distribution of the energy and its priority. Once you establish that energy, everything else can then be accommodated because there's a security there. And I don't want to get too strung out here, but my point is that you have the capacity, the influence. And when you say to me, how in the world would you do that? You could tell a young man that if he gets exceptional grades, that he's in line to have a free electric vehicle. But they'll have to buy a recording so they can hear the vehicle when it starts, because you probably want to take it out of the driveway at night because it's so quiet. But my point is that by you providing an electric vehicle for that child, that vehicle would go on to save thousands of gallons of gasoline, and that would save money for the community for you, and the gas you didn't buy would go into the pipeline to be sold, and the air pollution would go down. And at the same time, the child now learns about electrons and hydrogen, which is where it's all headed there very, very quickly. And at the same time, the child is engaged, and at the same time, you as a school can teach lessons on it. And by incentivizing that little child with an electric vehicle, he has to have a mother and a father. There was just priorities for those things that we bequeath as a society. And what happens is the other kid sees him going, wow, that's hot. Well, yeah, and we could buy 100,000 electric vehicles for about $1 billion or $1.5 billion, which is nothing. But more importantly, we could bring GM and Nissan and Toyota and I think there's five or six others, Mercedes, BMW, they're all building them now. And they could give testimony on how they would back them up for us. And we would say, well, we'll buy 100,000 for $1.5 billion, but I think what we'll do is we'll give them to parents with a certain age, and they have to have children. That's the first priority. And then it goes to a single parent, and then it goes to this. So what happens is when you combine that with the total number of residential units of about 300,000 in the state, you realize that 100,000 electric vehicles that you just bought, that's if you just bought them and they showed up on the parking on the driveway with a ribbon around it. It goes to show that you could, in effect, cause and affect your state overnight and every living creature on it. And then what I'm noticing here is something unusual. It appears to me that we're headed for some kind of a new society, and I'm not sure what it is, but it is energy-related. We're never going to look at energy in business as usual as we did in the past. They're coming up with carbon tax. We're beginning to realize that the oil companies have seized a sense of ownership under some guise of free enterprise, when the truth is we conveyed that opportunity to them for our benefit, and they've not done that. And so what I'm seeing here is the whole world is looking at energy. Just fascinating. And I go home, even at my age, and I don't like teched up and tooled up. I like to contemplate the nature of things without all the technology. And I turn on YouTube, and I fall asleep, and I think, boy, the young minds just must be picking up stuff at a huge pace. And when you look at it, it's all about the energy, because it all revolves around the energy. Whether you're a life form or a young woman who likes the lively young man or the pursuit of an activity, it's all about the energy. So I think that if you were begin to redirect the children of Alaska towards an energy mentality, in other words, you have the capacity to use your institution, which seems to be growing itself, and we're all concerned about that, but not putting out a product. You have an opportunity to not only take your assets and your tools and your impact politically, but you have a chance to morph Alaska within 2 to 6 years and grow the next society that this young man from the chamber was talking about. At the same time, you have a chance to gain world recognition from it and to put your children in a very, very special place. And I'm not sure I'm making that cohesive enough for you to understand the realms of that, because usually these take a bit bigger dialogue as opposed to somebody just presenting it without a presentation. So it seems to me that if I could get you to realize that I'm seeing you build large political bodies of influence. I'm seeing politicians just tremor at the prospect of coming in opposition against the schools or forming alliances with the oil companies and the colleges and into the business communities and into the wives and men's relationships. And you sit there seeing actually a whole new society being morphed now. And I'm pondering, I'm really concerned about where that's headed to. And it seems to me it has to fail. And when it collapses, it'll be something of the scale that we're seeing today. If we're not seeing it now, but what we're seeing today with the monetary market, for example, to put that in clearer terms, and I'm trying to draw correlations for you, it is not the money that's the problem. It's all those people who fed for nothing. When you come back to the fundamentals of life, it's about survival, and you have to work for it. It's clean air, clean water, and energy in a dwelling. And those are called areas of productivity. You produce, and you have a neighbor, and you build. But each one has something they contribute in some physical way, and then you expand your community, and you grow a quality of life. And somehow we've lost that quality of life that held us all together for some trinket economy from China or some other trunked-up situation or some funding of contrived methodology. We have forgotten what foundations work. So when you look at the money out there that they're all worried about, that's all people that didn't want to work. People that didn't want to work. You can see it in their eyes. They're just scared to death because there's no money. No, because they realize they've never really contributed. They've lived off the money, and they told us there's a need, but there hasn't been for the working people. But more seriously, if you look behind that, the truth is that energy is behind it all. Because you can't buy the energy if you don't have a stable society to hold the money together to purchase the energy. That's where you folks are headed. You're headed for a direct conflict with the money, whether you realize it or not. And I guarantee you, you're not going to be the priority, because when you get a dysfunctional family that goes dysfunctional into the neighborhood and starts taking down power lines and public distress, your institutions will go in a heartbeat, okay? All of them will. But when you look at it, it's about the energy. Because they can't put the energy out in the world unless they have stable pricing mechanisms. And they have bitten onto the world market. They can't go out to world market, so they're now trying to reconstruct an economy so the energy can be held together. In the meantime, energy is splintering. Electric vehicles, air cars, hydrogen fuel cells, water cars, they're all racing now to do something. In the meantime, on TV, you're hearing, well, they won't buy a vehicle. No, they won't buy a vehicle. Why would I buy a vehicle with an electric car coming out in 2 years? Why would I go to a credit company who's literally going to use me to make more money, who are the thieves to begin with, if I can be so harsh? At the same time, why would I buy a fossil fuel vehicle, which is going to charge me more money to run it, is unpredictable in its availability, and kills the climate, and then my neighbor next door gets an electric vehicle, and he saves money, and I got to make up for him not buying the gas? In other words, I think the young children are beginning to see the unraveling of the complexities. And the only way that you bring that back home is through energy and through that dwelling. Because if you have the electricity and the water and your dwelling, you can hold your family together. You can protect yourself, your neighbor. You can hold your neighborhood together. You can hold your community together. You can grow food. You can defend yourself. You can travel. And that's what we lost. We forgot about the fundamental needs to hold us in a sense of calmness and neighborness. So when I see folks like you, with the tremendous resources that you have available, and you're dealing with the families that are in struggle, females that were having gender conflicts and roles that are confusing, economies that are confusing, political signals that are confusing, political representatives, a whole slew of things just seem to be questionable or unclear anymore. So in the largesse of your institution, I'm trying to wrap that up. I don't get a chance to say these things that often, so I'm trying to stall for some time here. But I think you have a chance to have your children. I tried to tell them, you have a list here of some of the people on the governor's climate list. It's a magnificent list of people, and there's four or five energy groups that are formed up. Ms. Fairclough is one of them. But what you see is you see a lack of identity, and you see a conflict between the fossil fuelers trying to come back in, but the missing piece is energy. Alaska has no energy. Somebody just forgot all about it for 30 years, because if you have energy, you can do anything. Anything. You can ask any company to invite them to come. You can make a tool. You can hold together. You can grow food. You cannot talk to your neighbor. You can sit there in your house all the time if you want to, because we finally reached that day and age. But there's no energy in Alaska, and yet there's an abundance of it. So in my perspective, Alaska should be Alaska Atlantis. You should have 100 hydroelectric projects and wind and turbine projects, and there's all these new electric vehicles which can give you immediate.
Mr. Kimball?
Yes.
I think you need to wrap up here. We are talking about education issues. You're talking about there's no energy. We wouldn't be alive if we didn't have energy. You know, we born, we have energy. I don't follow you on everything that you're saying. I appreciate you giving me a copy of where your plan is. But as I said to you privately, if you are interested in pushing what you're saying, you got to have somebody supporting this plan. And if you don't have somebody supporting this and agreeing with what you're saying, you're just taking a walk. And I don't know how this connects to the education of our children.
Well, should I wrap up?
And every child do not have a parent. There's all kind of people that have to come in and support children to help them get where they need to be. Now, I was born in a small town. And in that town that I grew up in, I had a mother and I had a father. But I also had those people that was around in my community that cared for me and helped me along the way. I didn't have to just depend on my mother and my father, only communicate with them. It was the entire community. And you said every parent ought to be responsible for their children. No one needs to have to be responsible for them. I don't follow you. I want to read what you have here, but I don't see how this connects to what we're trying to do to make things better so that we make sure that we educate our children and we do it early and follow them through the process to see that they do get the education they need and training that they need so they may get out and get good jobs. And what you're saying don't get me there. And maybe there's more to this than what you have said.
Sure. Well, if I could wrap up and clarify that.
I'd like you to do that, because at this point, you know, I don't know how other people feel about it,
sure.
But that's it's just the way I feel about this. You're saying we're talking about energy. Yeah, we're going to deal with energy. We need energy. We're an energy state. Well, what has that got to do with the education of our children?
I know. If I might, let me admonish myself. I usually come with a plethora of things on my mind, and I'm lucky to get to five or six, and usually I wrap them all up together like a pinata or something. But I came here. I'm very disappointed in the school infrastructure. I think it's failing and flailing. And we're all just sitting back watching, waiting for it to collapse once the money runs out. But when I came here, I thought, you know, Paul, why do that? Why go into that? Why not contribute something positive? So I came to try to tie in the energy, because if I could tie the energy into it, rather than perhaps we could leap past those little differences of which no one's going to give ground on, that maybe they have to fail. And I was trying to bring the energy, I'd hope to show you that the problems you see of the females who no longer want to be patriarchal, the boys and girls who can't be boys and girls, and all the ideologies that we're seeing now, the Jewish holidays and all those things, I was trying to make the point to you that none of those things are possible. None of those things are possible without individual freedoms. And you can't have the individual freedoms until you have the energy, period. So all of these little exercises in different dispositions about societies, and we want to be this, we want to be that, it's never going to happen unless you have the respect of the individual's freedom. Never, never. Darfur is what lies around the corner for those who think it is. But once you have the energy that gives you freedom, then it's all possible. And so I was hoping that you could transcend all the differences, this hodgepodge, this babbling tower of all the differences of diversity and race and holidays and gender, that you could see that, hey, you know, there's a way to get around this. It's energy. And in producing that energy would make you the most magnificent people worldwide, and within 2 to 6 years, your children would have a brave new future. And I thank you for the opportunity to have come here and tried to espouse the complexity and confusion of my own thoughts. So I guess, unless you have questions, I'll get out of here.
Are there any questions of Mr. Kendall? There is no questions. We thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Is there anybody else who wants to testify at this time? I have no other... Excuse me.
Madam Chair, Mr. Kendall referred to me, so I just wanted I have been reading some of his material, and he questions our ability to notify the public. So I just wanted to put on the record right now that we have scheduled an energy meeting with the task force that I am chairing on October 21st from 10 to noon. We're trying to firm up an agenda, and I believe we have 2 House members that are able to attend, as well as 2 senators that are able to attend, and that had been the problem with scheduling and just the short time frame after coming out of special session. So we can't it's very difficult to give special invitations to everyone who's interested in a particular issue, because if we fail to notify that person, then it's shame on us. And so we publicly notice everything that we do,
yes.
And unfortunately that means people don't get personal invitations, including myself, to different things. I have to be involved, and I know that that's difficult, but just, Madam Chair, wanted to put on the record, since Mr. Kendall was very interested in that topic, that my staff sent out to our committee members this morning, and we should be in this LIO. I believe it has been reserved for us, and Mr. Hagginson has said that he would be able to give us a presentation for about an hour or a bit better on that date. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thanks for that information. And Mr. Kendall, I advise you to try to come to there where you can really talk about some of these energy concerns that you have. If there is no other testimony, we're going to close out at this point. We're going to leave things open until 5, since we said we would be here. But we are closing the meeting for those that are present and have already given their thoughts and comments. Thank you very much for attending, and also to the members that are still here, legislators. Thank you for sticking out with me, hanging out, and thanks for all your comments. We'll close now.